Oh, I didn't.
I didn't either.
That's too Schwab.
I did too.
I had actually been in the transportation staff while he was chairing.
Okay, if we can get going, with apologies, I had a couple people grab me upstairs. So what we'd like to do is to go through the agenda, and obviously the folks here tonight, our requests for funding, most of which have been in the legacy bill in the past. Let me just offer a couple of thoughts at the outset, and I'm going to repeat this tomorrow when we hear the list of bills. The first, let me offer a little bit of bad news. The request has been made of this subcommittee, and I certainly was a participant in this, but I think everybody's aware that the capital restoration, I don't know what happened with the commission that did the work. I was not on it. This goes back a couple of years ago. But there were certain things left out, and the dollar figure we've been given this year is that there's another $30 million that has to be taken into account for the capital restoration. Now, not that this committee is going to have to deal with $30 million, but what we do have to deal with is the art and some of the other restoration aspects, which amounts to about $3.25 million, roughly. I haven't had a chance to vet that, to know whether or not that's exactly the right figure. But I will tell people that probably takes care of most increases in budgets. And don't know that for a fact, but that's probably the case. The other couple of things to keep in mind relative to this section of the bill, more so than the other sections, the other parts of the bill, is folks will come forth. Well, here's, I don't know if we're going to hear this tomorrow, but some of the members will show up with requests that are bonding requests, and we've had the discussion about whether or not the issue of the constitutional issue of supplanting versus supplementing. Certainly, if we turn this into a bonding bill, I would argue that crosses the line into supplanting and would allow us to be subject to a constitutional challenge. I think I mentioned, and Senator Ingebrigtsen and Senator Saxhog, I know you had other commitments, but when we heard the council recommendations, the other body has talked about this PILT issue, which I think really does cross the line on the question of supplant. But it's something we've got to watch out for. Someday somebody's going to take us to court. Somebody who is displeased with what we've done or not done. And so I think in this instance of particularly this part of the amendment, we do get into some of those concerns. There are some other concerns I'll voice tomorrow relative to this section of the bill, because I think a lot of the individual requests we have are for this section. There's some clean water. We've talked about that the Senate historically has passed on the recommendations of the Lessard-Sams Council, and I think that would meet with the support of the senators on the council, Senator Ingebrigtsen and Senator Saxhog. And the Parks and Trails has a couple of issues, but we have talked about whatever the appropriate division is. But I do want to mention that in particular that there is the issue of this capital restoration, and this certainly would be done on a one-time basis. This would not be the case the next time we do this bill, but it might create some problems this year. I'm not sure where we intend to get the other 26 and three-quarters million. I think the anticipation would be that the only real choice in that case would be a bonding bill, but we've not looked to other divisions for funding the capital restoration. The closest would be Senator Saxhog's division, and his bill just passed, and that bill has a smaller target with how we've handled the division. You couldn't turn $30 million over to that division to take care of the capital restoration. So just wanted to make those comments. So
Mr. Chairman, can I have it in my division? The $30 million, can I have that
in my division? Or?
No. Well, I'm sorry, Senator Thomasoni, you misunderstood me. The point is we don't have that.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Otherwise, we would have given it to Senator Saxog. That was the point I was trying to make. So.
He's trying.
He's clever, but that wasn't he's been more clever than that question. We've got a number of folks. We've got this grouped into various areas, and I think members should have the agenda and the list of witnesses. So first we have the Bell Museum, and we've got three folks scheduled. So welcome to the subcommittee. So if you just want to identify yourself and happy to listen.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I am Professor Weller, Director of the Bell Museum of Natural History and Planetarium at the University of Minnesota.
And my name is Lee Famuller. I'm Chair of the Advisory Board for the Bell Museum and Planetarium. And our third member isn't here today. But we wanted to start out by just thanking the legislature for the very generous general fund appropriation to help us build a new Bell Museum and Planetarium during the last year's session. I know a number of you on the committee were very strong supporters of that effort, and we really are very, very appreciative of that support. We have now actually hired an architect, Perkins and Will, who's already begun in the last month to do design work for the new facility. And we expect to break ground in the summer of 2016 and actually have a new facility for you all to visit in 2018. What we're doing now is being really busy about not only participating in the design of the facility, but also planning programs for that new facility. And what we're here with today is a new request for some programming that we're really excited about.
And so, Mr. Chair and committee members, we're really pleased to have this opportunity to provide you with an overview of our proposal, Building a Cultural Understanding, Stories from the Home Planet. The key details of our request are in your handout, and I'm going to just go over the high points in this brief presentation. Now, the word culture has many meanings. To many of us, it can mean the visual and performing arts, human history, cultural history. And I would argue that in Minnesota, culture also incorporates the understanding of our environmental history. And our passion for the land, our recreational use, hunting, fishing, is a really important part of our Minnesota cultural heritage. And Minnesota is increasingly diversifying, and so it is in our best interest to build a shared understanding of this really important environmental cultural heritage so that our future voters, children like these, will come to have an understanding and appreciation of our natural resources so they conserve them and use them wisely. Now, our approach is to use the power of storytelling and our portable planetarium, which you can see set up here in a school gym in Winona. And within this space, we have a digital presentation in which we can transport students to visit the stars or learn about their home planet Earth. And so, for example, our museum educators can provide lessons on weather, water, and land use here in Minnesota and globally. Aided by our digital planetarium, we're able to foster this shared understanding of our environment. And here you see our current reach. In a three-year time period, we've been able to serve 45 Minnesota counties. We are somewhat limited by having just one portable planetarium, which is why we are asking for a second one, as well as educator workshops to ensure that this investment by the state is sustainable once the funding is complete. And what we are proposing is to deliver a program which is in its pilot phase right now. It's entitled Stories from the Home Planet, Historias de Nuestro Planeta, It is currently funded by the U.S. State Department. We basically have a Fulbright program for museums, and with Colombian educators and the St. Paul school teachers, we are developing lessons on climate and local environmental challenges. And the goal of this program really, truly, is to inspire our students to become better stewards of our planet. One of our advantages is, well, location, location, location. We are located in a Big Ten university, and we don't have to wait for the textbooks to be written. We can bring science into the classrooms with an immediacy and freshness that's really important for inspiring students. Further, we have independent evaluations that demonstrate that our programs are effective in closing the achievement gap, and we're very proud of having served over 700 fifth graders in the Minneapolis schools each year for the past 3 years. And last, one of our important advantages is our statewide collaborations. We are part of a network of planetariums across the state, and this will enable us to sustain the program once we complete the 2 years of funding. And so precisely what we're asking for is $535,000 over 2 years to prepare our future voters to use and protect our natural resources wisely. There are other details in the handout, and here you see that we have the intent to support educator professional development workshops. Again, that is to ensure the sustainability of the program, leveraging our network partners, and filling in the gaps between our partners with our portable planetarium system. And so with this, I will be quiet and thank you for your attention, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. A couple of questions. First of all, what's your relationship to the university in terms of structure, control management, and so on, budget?
So the museum was established, as you know, in 1872 by the legislature as the state's natural history museum, and then immediately transferred to the University of Minnesota, who is our parent organization. I report to the Dean of the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences, Dean Bohr, and so our governance is by the Board of Regents at the University of Minnesota, and I am privileged to have an advisory board, which Lee Fanmuller so ably chairs. And this board is comprised of citizens that are drawn from the community who have a passion for the museum and planetarium.
So you're within the purview of directly of the university?
Yes, sir. My about 80%, 75% of my budget comes from the University of Minnesota.
So I'm sorry, how much? 75?
75 to 80% of my budget. The public museum part, though, so I have faculty and scientific collections, and those are closer to 90% funded by the state because they are teaching and doing research. The public museum part has roughly 30% in earned revenue that we earn every year to support our programs. And I would be willing to provide you with our annual report for the rest, but that's the rough numbers.
So is there any foundation support or anything of that sort?
Yes, sir. We do have endowments, and we do get gifts and grants, and I'm afraid the exact percent is escaping me right at the moment.
Okay. So if you'll allow me, here's my concern. I think I've voiced this before, but and it's going to be a question. Let me just present another question to everybody that's here. When we were engaged in the promulgation of the Constitutional Amendment, and we discussed this section of the bill in particular. I think this happened with all parts of the amendment, but it's happened especially with this section. What we didn't anticipate, I don't think anybody anticipated on this committee, the 2008 credit collapse, since we passed it. Senator Miller didn't, since he wasn't a member of the Senate then. We can't blame him at all. You know, we passed the bill, as members recall. There was discussion in the Senate in 2005, 2006. We passed the bill in 2007, the final passage in January of 2008. So when I say we didn't anticipate the credit collapse, obviously I'm being a little bit facetious. But what happened then is subsequent to that, everybody viewed this as kind of like, you know, the one pot of free money in town, and it's not quite as simple as that. And so what I'm going to ask of some of and the Bell Museum wouldn't fall into this as such, and I don't think what we have tonight necessarily falls into it. It's more a question of tomorrow. But there are a couple of places where when we talk about a grant to nonprofits, and we'll talk about this a little bit greater length tomorrow, usually the most that a nonprofit's received from, and I'm a huge proponent of this, and in fact I'm proud of the fact that I got the Legislator of the Year Award from the Council of Nonprofits, but the most that a nonprofit usually has gotten is somewhere 3 to 10% of that organization's operating budget, and that higher number where the organization has been a smaller organization. In particular, though, with the Bell Museum, how are you distinguished from a place like Northrop? And the reason I mention that is that Northrop's never looked for any support from the legislature for programming. So how would you distinguish yourself from Northrop?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Northrop is a beloved institution of the performing arts. It does receive indirectly some state support as part of the University of Minnesota through its governance, its the land support of its operations, the in-kind, if you will, of energy, lights, water, and so forth. So we are different in that as a museum of natural history with scientific collections, we also contribute to that teaching and research mission of the university. Am I answering your question? I'm afraid I may have gone a little bit,
because I think, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Jens could correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think the Wiseman or Northrop get any money, say, from the State Arts Board, I don't believe. Ms. Jens, is that okay? And so when we've had requests for those organizations, which seem to me to be somewhat similar, if I'm not, you know, I understand that we're talking natural history as opposed to more of a, in one case, a visual arts museum, in our case, a performing arts center. They've been under the purview of the university. And so, for instance, the new Northrop was clearly a bonding request from the university, and I recognize that that was a fight over the years in terms of what we did with the Bell Museum. Sarah Stumpf can speak to that much better than I can, and Senator Bonhoff. So as to what happened with, but I'm very pleased that we were able to resolve that issue and proceed with the new Bell Museum. But it's always been done within the purview of the university. And again, I'm going to look, Senator Bonhoff is saying no.
Well, the
bonding request was not done that
right,
way.
Right, and we were just remembering that the, Mr. Chair, the Northrop came from the HEPER funding in the bonding bill.
But through the university.
Right.
Whereas the bill was last year kind of this additional.
Exactly, where we paid for the debt service.
So what I'm trying to figure out is, you know, is the right place here, and I'm not looking to create more problems or trouble for anybody, but you know, whether or not it's a higher education appropriation as opposed to a legacy appropriation. The other thing is, and this is just an aside, and Senator Bonhoff will also offer correction if necessary. My sense is President Keeler has been fairly strict about, at least the extent that he can be, of requests coming to the legislature that have not come through the university. And we got into that, Senator Stevens, Senator Bonhoff, myself, with the regenerative medicine request last year, and not so much with Well, you remember in the conference committee, the Supplemental Finance Committee, the House made that argument that we were kind of circumventing the process, and President Kaler kind of made it clear that's not going to happen again.
And, Mr. Chair, many members this session have brought independent bills that were outside the region's priority list.
So that's why I want to, because you have not been in front of this subcommittee before, I wanted to just have some sense of the governance and where you kind of fit within the structure of the university. And I mentioned Wiseman and Northrop as being a couple of, there could be other examples where we have kind of a subset of the university, and that's why I wasn't quite sure where the Bell Museum fit. So any thoughts on that? Or
Mr. Chair, I just might address one aspect of what you brought up, which is that we did notify, we aren't going totally independent on this. We did notify the legislative office of the university, and they gave us the green light to go ahead.
Okay, so that's important to know.
Yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might add, we have, just as the Weissman and Northrop have gone to the Minnesota State Board of the Arts for funding, we have made requests of the Minnesota Historical Society through their competitive grants program. The environmental work we do falls in an odd space that doesn't fit well their program guidelines.
It sounds a little bit different, but I will tell you, when I asked about the Wiseman and Northrop, Ms. Jens was indicating that there has not been State Arts Board support. There is? Ms. Jens, I might ask that when you get up here. For both organizations there has been, or just for Wiseman? Because I know there's been some debate about that. But again, your testimony is that most of the money comes from the university, and there's some money through earned revenue. Is that correct? But there's not been foundation money.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we have some endowments and gifts from donors, including corporate foundations and private family foundations, which are deposited at the University of Minnesota Foundation, which may be more detail than you wish to have, but that's typically, I would want to double check my annual report for the exact numbers.
Okay, so in terms of donated income as opposed to earned income, that's directed through the foundation, and I've made some contributions like that where I would cite a particular part of the university, and the money's directed then to that program or area of the university. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. For example, the Yellow Bus Fund from the Wiesner Foundation goes to the University Foundation. We use it to provide scholarships to schools in need so that they can come and do our honeybee programs and other programs.
Okay. All right. So other questions, members of the subcommittee? Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just briefly comment on the move and what's happening with the move?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff. We are in the process of schematic design, we are working hard to stay on track to break ground in a year from this summer, so the summer of 2016, and then construction, and we'll be opening it up in the summer of 2018.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have the libraries. Okay, and I think we have another handout being distributed.
That's
by.
That's what I was just going to look.
Committee page. Okay. So welcome to the subcommittee. Just identify yourselves. And
we have a prop, so we're waiting for that to get set up.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, the legislature always likes props.
We'll be gentle. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Just if you could identify yourself, please.
I'm Ann Hutton. I'm the executive director for SELCO, Southeastern Libraries Cooperating, one of the 12 regional public library systems that is honored to be a recipient of Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund funds for library legacy activities. 60 years ago, when the legislature had the vision of creating Minnesota library regions, it did so with the understanding and the belief that regardless of where Minnesotans lived, they needed access to information. And so we have been moving materials and books and videos to Minnesotans throughout that long history. So when the Minnesota voters chose to do the arts and the legacy amendment, it seemed a perfect vehicle to take this structure that was already in place, the 365 public libraries, and since they were already working in communities, collaborating with community partners, this committee and the your counterparts in the House so chose to fund the library legacy part of the amendment. So we are very thankful for that appropriation. You have in your handouts a statement from the Minnesota Library Association supporting the request for $4,255,000. On the back side of that map is, or on the back side of that one-page handout, there is a map of Minnesota, and we do highlight one activity from each of the 12 regions. I can assure you, as you can see from the numbers on the bottom of the front page, there are far more activities than just one in every region. I'll give you a couple of examples of some of our of the great things that have been going on. Since I have a prop in front of me, I'll start with that one. You have in your handouts, or I think this may have been an after handout, a booklet, and I would draw your attention to pages 6 and 7. This was a project undertaken by the East Central Regional Library. It's those counties north of the metro, but not quite as far north as the Arrowhead region. They undertook an art contest with children in each of their libraries, a glass blower, then selected the award-winning art in each of those communities, award-winning in that it was a piece of art from a picture that he knew that he could transfer from the concept of a child's drawing into a piece of art. So you have on pages 6 and 7 the actual drawing by the child, complete with pirate misspelled, but they left it correct in the eyes of the child, and then a photo of the parrot. As you can see, while the color photography is nice, the real piece of artwork is far more stunning. The library staff from East Central Regional Library chose not to bring the hamburger because that's about a 35-pound piece of art. Each of the libraries in East Central Regional Library, in essence, ended up with a piece of art from their community. This is truly one of those times when the sum of its parts is actually greater, because when you get all 14 pieces of art together, it is an amazing feature. So that's just one example of what has been happening in libraries. I see on your agenda tonight you later have information from the Minnesota Historical Society, and I want to say that we in libraries have been working very closely. We have been a sponsor of History Day and holding hullabaloos. I just received a report from Tim Hoagland, who's known as Mr. History Day, and he was saying how the attendance and participation in this year's History Day has gone up almost 25%, and he attributes a lot of the great award-winning programs that the kids have been doing at the national level to the increased use of libraries through History Day. One of the things that was started, and as was mentioned earlier as the senator was opening this proceedings, as to how this was supposed to, the legacy dollars were supposed to supplement local activities, and I think that there is, and how we wanted, the vision was to grow the community. In my own region, there's Spring Grove, and it's a very small community, about 1,200 people. Again, through a partnership with the Minnesota Historical Society, we were able to bring a very exciting program to the community. 128 people showed up, and that's one of those easy times when you can do the math and understand that it really did affect a large portion of that community. The program was based on the Minnesota Historical Society award-winning Minnesota's Greatest Generation. Part of the program involved renting a piano, and this is where the legacy really does happen, in that by the end of the performance, a number of people in the audience had thought, we need a piano. And so they went from having rented the piano for the evening for the performance by Prudence Johnson, and they decided they would do fundraising at the local level, and they would buy a piano. And since that time then, the piano has been available for local concerts. So it really is the beauty of state dollars appropriated to libraries, a library-sponsored program, which then turned into a community asset and a community legacy. So thank you very much for your support of libraries overall and certainly of library legacy activities within the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Thank you.
And I'm Melinda Ludwizak. I'm a project manager for MELSA, the Metropolitan Library Service Agency. I work with 100 libraries in the metro area in creating the magic of the legacy funding programs out there in our region. And we try to reach people of all ages across Minnesota, from babies and preschoolers to teens and older adults, 365 libraries in small towns to neighborhoods and large cities provide access to these programs in the arts, our culture, our history, and our literature. We provide spaces for public art, such as the project you see here, but there are also projects that engage the community in making that art. For example, we have created several murals in our public libraries where, say, an art teacher will work with students from a local high school to envision that artwork and actually create it, and the students are paid to be part of that project. And then there'll be a community celebration as kind of an art opening of that project. We've also done mosaic projects in the Great River Regional Library System in the St. Cloud area. They worked with a mosaic artist to create a public art piece that was a symbol of the community in every public library. So in the Buffalo Library, they have a mosaic of a buffalo in their public library. We have exhibitions spaces in our libraries where local artists can display their work. You have several brochures in your packet there of some examples of these projects where photographers and painters and other visual artists are able to display their work in our libraries, and we use the legacy funds to purchase the hanging hardware and create a process where artists can display their work. We've also worked with historical societies. There's an example of an exhibit we worked with the Ramsey County Historical Society. They had an exhibit on how they played they played for the love of the game. It's looking at the history of black baseball in Minnesota. And we worked with them to create a smaller exhibit that toured our libraries. And out of that, the curator, Frank White, heard more stories about this and was able to incorporate new information that he discovered when he was out in the community at our libraries. And out of that is a result of a book deal with the University of Minnesota Press. So that story will be coming out this fall. We've done thousands of live music and theater performances where performers will tour the regional library circuit. So we bring everything from classical music and jazz to puppet theater, bluegrass, and Cajun dances. We share local history to overflow crowds, and these are presented by local historical societies. I got an email today from the Anoka County Library that their monthly programs with their historical society are overflowing and they're turning people away. So we're looking at ways to create more of those events so more people can participate and hopefully in the future do more podcasting of those programs so we can preserve them. We also work with the public in doing their own genealogy research. The Minneapolis Central Library and Hennepin County Library created an African American Heritage Conference a couple years ago where hundreds of people came and got instruction in how to do better research in this real specific area. We have a lot of hands-on art making in creative writing, drawing, painting, photography, and much more. We also provide opportunities for teaching artists authors, performers, musicians, and historians to meet their audiences at the libraries of all sizes in their little towns and local neighborhoods. We also strive to impact targeted populations. An example of our early childhood programming is a CD that you have there. This is the second one we've produced with McPhail Center for Music. And this is handed out to families at our library so that they can incorporate the work that McPhail has done in the area of early childhood and how music enhances reading skills. And inside is a little booklet to help the parents figure out how to use that. You have a copy of Moo. This book won the Minnesota Book Award last year, and we commissioned the author and illustrator, who are both Minnesotans, to create a program that is launched through our Once Upon a Reader program. This is an all-state reading program of a children's picture book. So we have taken this book to all the Head Start children in the state of Minnesota, and Dave and Mike, the author illustrators, have created a show with a puppet. So they bring Moo out to our libraries and do a show to standing room only crowds all over the state and get kids excited about this book and reading in general. They're even invited to send a postcard to Cal, and Cal responds, and a lot of that gets posted on our website. And we have a program for teens. It's coming up in a couple weeks. I hope you can join us. It's called Teen Lit Con, and we bring authors from that appeal to teens at Sibley High School, and we have busloads of students from all over the metro and other parts of the state come all together. They get to meet their authors, go to workshops on creative writing and how to get published, and all kinds of activities that day. The library club of students at the high school are our hosts, and they meet every bus as it comes up to the high school, and they help create this wonderful event. And lastly, we do a lot of programming for older adults and doing hands-on art-making programs, whether it's creative writing or painting or drawing or photography, and we incorporate the latest research in how older adults learn. And so we do classes that are several weeks long where people get a chance to try out one of these disciplines and at the end have a culminating celebration event. It also creates a group of cohorts that are working together on a project. And we've had a lot of success in those programs, and every one of them is filled to capacity, and we're hoping to do even more. So that gives you a little snapshot of the kind of programming that we're doing across the state, and we're happy to entertain any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee about either geography or... So we've got some of the material you've prepared. You indicate that you've serviced 365 libraries. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes. There is 365 libraries that are recognized by the Minnesota Department of Education, and then there is a number of library outreach activities as well.
Okay. Now, I think when this was originally suggested in 2009, because we hadn't talked about this prior to this, I think it was thought there'd be an appropriation of about $50,000 per library. Is that correct? And is that still kind of a figure that's been utilized, or?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, initially the formula that was set into state statute mirrored the regional library basic system support, and that works sort of in that there is a component for a base amount, a geography, as well as population. And that makes sense because you're dealing, people are attending programs, and it does take money and time to take authors and illustrators around the state. One of the factors that did not work initially with the funding formula was a factor based on property values. There's no real correlation with cultural history, library, literature necessarily with property values. And so the legislature in the last biennium changed the formula to be still the base
population, geography-based, and then also on a factor of the number of library buildings, with the idea that, generally speaking, libraries were going to be hosting these programs within their four walls or working with community partners within those communities.
So the grants to the various regions are based upon, there's some variance depending on number of libraries, serviced populations, and so on.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Next, we have the Minnesota Children's Museum. Yeah, we love props, but... Welcome to the subcommittee. And members, I think you've figured out that the handouts are in order of the presentation we have on the agenda. Please present.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. Diane Kreisen, President of Minnesota Children's Museum. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this evening. And I did not bring props with me today, but to try to bring to life what we did. There is a brochure that has tries to bring to life through photos what we have done with legacy funding in the prior appropriations. So many are familiar with Minnesota Children's Museum. But yet what many don't know about the museum is that we are the number one producer of traveling exhibits in the children's museum field. So we have 12 exhibits that tour in North America. And what legacy funding has really helped to do for us is to bring that skill set, that competency that we have in designing exhibits and experiences for children to learn through play. We have been able to bring that across the state and really focusing on the arts access part of the legacy amendment and enhancing arts education through these experiences. So in your brochure on the inside, on the left-hand side, is a listing of the initiatives that have been done with the prior appropriations and the history of that funding. Just to highlight a few things now, thanks to legacy funding, families in Rochester and the surrounding area of southeastern Minnesota now have a children's museum in their community. In addition to that, 13 cities in greater Minnesota have had the opportunity to host an exhibit called Storyland in their communities, where it would stay for 3 months and then move on to another committee. So we have been from Thief River Falls to Worthington with that tour. In addition to that, we have permanent installations of Minnesota Children's Museum branded exhibits in 19 communities around the state. And we have selected the placement of those sites based on trying to reach the large number of families with children, but particularly focusing on the number of children living in poverty in those communities and also the geographic distance away from Minnesota Children's Museum. So we're as close as the Rondo neighborhood in St. Paul, which has a high concentration of high-need families, and yet close to the museum, and as far away as the White Earth Nation, and all sorts of locations in between and all over the state. I also did want to point out on the back of the brochure are some maps that show the visitorship and where it comes from around the state of Minnesota. So to our flagship location in St. Paul, we do have visitors that come from all corners and every county of the state. And so in addition to that, we have created enhanced experiences at our location in St. Paul with legacy funding. We've created large collaborative arts experiences. We've created unique opportunities for children to use their imagination and to invent their own stories. And we've also created opportunities for children to really be able to get hands-on with real tools and real materials that we often don't think of putting into the hands of children. And I just want to share a couple stories to bring that to life for you. One of the experiences we created is we had sewing machines, like and had real sewing machines and fabric that children could select whatever they wanted to select and create whatever they wanted to create. And one day at the museum, there was a mother who came in with a 3-year-old boy, and she thought, "Oh no, that's not for you. That's for older kids for you." And our visitor services staff said, "Well, no, let's just try it. It's okay. We'll sit down and we'll show how to run a sewing machine." And so that little boy picked out his two pieces of fabric and, you know, placed them together, and the staff person showed the child how to kind of push the foot pedal down and to kind of move the fabric through. And that boy was so proud that he got two pieces of fabric to stick together. And his mother was just amazed at, the idea of letting her child explore and use real material. So by the end of their visit, she was asking, "Now, where did you get this sewing machine from? And I think I might want to get one of these things at home." Another sewing example that I wanted to share the story of as a family that came in, and the child in this family just diligently worked and worked and worked to create this sort of rectangular-ish shape and stuffed the shape. And in the conversation with our visitor services staff, we came to discover that this family was living in a homeless shelter. And the story that the child told about what she created was she was so proud of it because at the homeless shelter where she lives with her mom, they don't have pillows, you know. So it was this opportunity to have an experience that she just wasn't having in her everyday life. So so those are the kind of experiences that we've created with the appropriations in the past. And all told, those appropriations have reached more than 900,000 visitors. So this biennium, we've come to request an appropriation of $1.4 million for specific initiatives that will reach into 9 communities and, again, serving families all over the state. Those initiatives are outlined on the right-hand side of your brochure, and I'll just briefly walk through those. So at the St. Paul location, which, again, does attract visitors from all over the state, we're looking to do some special exhibitions that continues some of the experiences that I've been talking about recently with those unique opportunities for children to have exposure to things they haven't previously had. In particular, we're really interested in the idea of bringing creative media technology and into the hands of children and seeing them explore with those really kind of cutting-edge technology that's happening out there now. In addition, we would like to have visiting artists come in and create opportunities for children to co-create with those artists in whatever medium, you know, that artist explores. And so it could be a cardboard artist, it could be a wood carving artist, it could be a creative media technology artist. But that idea to have an artist demonstrate what they create and provide opportunities for children to participate in creating along with that same medium. Thanks. Secondly, at our museum in Rochester, Minnesota, we would want to create classroom experiences. That's a relatively new museum, thanks to legacy funding that started up. I think we're coming up on our 4-year anniversary this month, now that I think about it. As we continue to build that out, some classroom experiences there that really create hands-on art experiences, as well as to be able to help support a changing lineup of exhibits that can continue to keep that experience there fresh, as it's a smaller museum. The opportunity to keep things fresh is really important for keeping it a vital experience. Thirdly, we would look to open a pop-up museum in the Twin Cities metro area. Thanks to funding through the capital investment bill last session, the Minnesota Children's Museum is poised to start construction this fall. And so as we are phasing through the construction and staying open for most of that time, but we will have galleries that are closed, so our capacity will be reduced. In addition to that, we will have a period of closure a year from now. And during that time, that opportunity to have our visitors have a children's museum experience at another location, as well as that opportunity then to see how that goes and to test the long-term viability of serving audiences with this additional location. And lastly, that tour of Storyland that did start with our first appropriation of legacy funding. We have had great receptivity in the cities that we've gone to. We've focused on Greater Minnesota for that, to have a piece of Minnesota Children's Museum located in a community that is further away from St. Paul, so it limits the amount of time that families, the frequency that families can visit. And so with that, we would be able to go to six more communities around the state. So that is our request for this session, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Questions from members of the committee. Now, there's an additional bonding request to supplement. It's a little bit aside from this subcommittee, but isn't there some additional work that...
There's not a dollar bonding request this time, but I believe the conversation you're referring to is some technical language correction around that.
And so where are you making that request? I know you and I have had a chance to talk about this, but...
Right. So we, of course, are talking with the Capital Investment Committee in both bodies as well as that, and then getting advice from the chairs of those committees to also look at not knowing if there is going to be a bonding bill passed this session, to also look at a cash bill that would also include those technical language corrections potentially. So that's the conversation we had had of whether the legacy bill might be that appropriate bill to put that in.
Okay. And that was the advice you had from Senator Stumpf?
Senator Stumpf, as well as, I'm embarrassingly drawing a blank, Representative Torkelson? I'm drawing a blank on the chair of the cabinet. Thank you.
Okay, other questions from the subcommittee? Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Okay, next we have the Minnesota Zoo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jane Prohaska, the Director of Public Affairs at the Minnesota Zoo. First, I send my apologies for not having Lee Emke with us this evening, the President and Director of the Zoo. I think some of you know that Lee is also the President of the World Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and this month he is taking care of some official responsibilities for WASA and is, in fact, in Europe at the moment with the WASA Council doing some work on the international scale. So I'm making the presentation on behalf of the zoo, but it is the zoo's official request. You do have a brief handout that does outline our request this year, and we'll go into that in a little bit more detail. I think some of you have already seen presentations about the zoo, but I did want to give a bit of an overview about the zoo, about the importance of legacy funding, both programmatically and financially, and then a few details about our request this year. I'm going to scoot over to the PowerPoint. I think you know the mission of the zoo is to connect people animals and the natural world, and increasingly of importance is to save wildlife, not just to make the connections, but as a result of those connections, actually save wildlife. The Minnesota Zoo is, in fact, a public-private partnership, has been created that way from the beginning, and operates that way today. A few quick facts about the zoo itself. We're home to 4,700 animals on a 485-acre campus. We have more than 1.2 million guests a year. And, in fact, this fabulous weather this weekend, we had 20,000 folks visiting the zoo, many of whom have come to rely on the programming provided by legacy funds to really enjoy their experience at the zoo to its fullest. Of those 1.2 million guests, we give away 120,000 or more free passes to economically disadvantaged Minnesotans, and also a number of discounted admissions throughout the year to school children and to other groups such as veterans and special programs that the zoo puts on each year. We also, in order to supplement what we can do with staff, we have over 1,000 volunteers that contribute more than 100,000 hours of volunteer time, a truly remarkable commitment by our volunteers, and it really changes the experience for those who visit the zoo. We have almost 500,000 participants in our educational programs, 90,000 school participants, 11,000 of those students visiting the zoo for free, primarily as a result of private fundraising, but also as a result of some of the past legacy funding that we've been able to use in that regard. We also have our Zoomobile, which takes a zoo out around the state, which visited 55 counties last year, over 50,000 participants in that program. Again, some of that based on funding that we received through the legacy amendment. And the zoo increasingly is a recognized leader in conservation and saving wildlife in Minnesota and around the world, with an increased emphasis, again with legacy funding, on wildlife right here in Minnesota. The zoo has been and continues to be an extraordinary economic engine for our state. We have diverse funding sources, public, private, corporate. As a result of this, we have $146 million annual economic impact. We support almost 1,700 jobs, and for each dollar that the state invests, we get a $26 return on that investment. Really an important investment for the state. Our programs, I think most of you are familiar with them, especially the recreational programs. It's a great, fun place for Minnesota families to visit. Our conservation programs are increasingly important, as I've mentioned, to the state and actually to the world. And education, the number of students that we serve both at the zoo and by bringing the zoo electronically and Zoomobile is of increasing importance and something, again, that we've used legacy funding to support. Our past history of legacy funding, you can see that it's been an important component of the zoo's annual operating budget. It's clear it has been, in the last year, a full 7% of our operating budget, compared to 22% that we receive from the general fund. 60% of our revenues come from earned incomes, admissions, and related revenues. But the legacy funding has become increasingly important so that we can expand and enhance certain programs throughout the year. It's also been an important way for us to really fulfill that public-private partnership. For example, the Hannah Foltz Family Wildwoods Nature Play Area, which will open this summer, has been is being created as we speak, primarily with private funds. But with a small legacy investment, we were able to complete that project and fully fund it other sources of public funding. Similarly, the Black Bear exhibit on the Minnesota Trail was done primarily with private funds, but with legacy funds rounding that out to provide some important interpretive and other educational materials in the exhibit. The programmatic importance of legacy funds, our past investments are significant and are in four key areas. Conservation in Minnesota, where we've worked with the University of Minnesota and DNR on key moose research, with the zoo using what it knows best, animal physiology, using our veterinarians to complement the work that is done by others, to really understand some of the impacts on moose. In particular, the zoo has been looking at some of the issues around microclimates for moose and how they adapt to those very specific areas on the landscape when it gets hot, quite frankly. But using our unique skills to supplement what the university and what DNR can bring to the table to help get a bigger picture, a better picture about what's happening with our moose. Similarly, we've been working with DNR on returning genetically pure bison to state parks. A lot of the bison that you find in a number of areas, public and private, now have been bred over years with some cattle genes, making it, quite frankly, a slightly different species. And the zoo has some genetically pure animals that we've been working with DNR to place those animals back on the landscape. Conservation education in Minnesota has been the area, quite frankly, where we spent most of our legacy funds. And we will continue to spend our legacy funds primarily in that area. It's been an important way to, again, bring the zoo throughout the state and also enhance the experience of the zoo, of visitors to the zoo in a variety of educational arenas. The Minnesota farming heritage is something we all know and care about, and the zoo has used a small portion of its legacy funds to expand the hours of its Wells Fargo family farm, which is truly popular this month. If you still get there, you can see farm babies, an incredibly popular exhibit with little baby goats, pigs, chicks. And it's really, but not just focusing on the core season, we can expand that season on the shoulder seasons by using legacy funds. And encourage more people to connect with our heritage parks. Finally, in our past legacy allocations, we've spent some money on our own site, restoring some of the natural habitat that exists on the site. Of those 485 acres, fully 280 acres plus are really relatively natural areas and are important for local species in addition to the core zoo site. So that's been a place we've used money in the past. Going forward, we're asking for $4.5 million over the biennium. Again, most of the money would be spent on conservation education in Minnesota, with a large amount also being spent on Minnesota's natural heritage, a small amount on farming, and then importantly for evaluation and program management. A little more specifics on that. Again, we would be continuing the moose research and the bison reintroduction that I mentioned. Both those projects would continue this biennium. And again, working with natural heritage education programs at the zoo and throughout the state. We've created a curriculum, natural heritage curriculum, that focuses on Minnesota's unique natural history. And we would again be using this funding to continue to bring that curriculum, spread that curriculum throughout the state and use it as students visit the zoo. New for the next biennium would be a focus on those species, mussels, frogs, and turtles, that are native to our Minnesota rivers, lakes, and wetlands. These are important native species, some of whom are the very important in water, others of which are the canary in the coal mine, and can let us know when things aren't going well in those water bodies. Again, working with DNR and the university, we would initiate this project. It would be new primarily for the zoo to work on these species, but looking to propagate and reintroduce endangered species, perhaps right on our lake. We have some a large lake right at and the main part of the zoo's campus, but some other water bodies as well. But using the zoo's facilities, its natural areas, as well as its expertise to work in this important area. Conservation education in Minnesota. Again, these would be continuing many of the programs that we've already expanded with prior legacy funding. The Zoo Mobile is one of the most important and popular programs of the zoo. We brought those animals here. We didn't bring any tonight, but interactions with live animals is one of the ways children and adults can connect most with the natural world. Josh is shaking his head. How come there's no demand to it tonight? Having a contact with live animals captures people's imagination and attention, and if we can bring and gets them interested in the natural world, we can bring that to more places throughout the state. We can engage more Minnesotans in understanding their natural history. Close Encounters has been extraordinarily popular at the zoo, where animals stay on site but come out from behind their exhibits and interact with the public. Again, when some of the House Legacy members were at the zoo, we were able to bring out an African porcupine that I'm told actually can scare lions. But a variety of these animals come out and interact with the guests that are at the zoo and, again, capture their attention and provide information and education about natural critters. The bird show, again, a very popular and educational program. We're able to expand the number of times we show that during the year with legacy money. And then what's not always so obvious, but the exhibit design and interpretation of behind some of these programs, we've been able to use some legacy money to enhance those educational opportunities for those visiting the zoo. New for the next biennium would be a focus on technology and access. With technology, we can both enhance a visitor's experience at the zoo through all sorts of interactive electronic means, but we can also, through technology, bring the zoo experience throughout the state through distance learning. Webcams are amazing, and we have a fabulous teacher who does our distance learning right now, and expanding that so we can reach all the way up to Roseau or other places in the state, as well as those people who can visit the state, is an important way to use that technology. We also understand that this is the state zoo. The Minnesota Zoo is a state agency, and it should be a zoo for all Minnesotans. We don't always provide the access that we think we need to some of Minnesota's diverse communities. Social, economic, other communities don't always take advantage of the zoo the way we hope they could. So we'd like to use legacy funds to expand new programs to help improve our ability to make the zoo accessible to all Minnesotans. And again, our farming heritage, continue the expansion of our hours that we can keep the family farm open, and add some seasonal events. Like right on the zoo site, we do a farmer's market with some of things that have been grown at our own farm. Evaluation and administration. While not as much fun as some of the other programs, we recognize the importance of holding the zoo accountable for how it uses its funds, of having measurable outcomes, of using our funds properly, and really evaluating those programs as we go forward so that we know which ones need to be modified, changed, so that we have the most effective use of legacy funds available. Thank you for your past support. We think we have a strong program going forward. We did leave, as I mentioned, a handout that sets out some of the details of our request. And we hope to answer any questions and hope you all come out to the zoo whenever you can.
Questions from the committee. Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I need a little more explanation on why there's $450,000 going to evaluation and administration.
Right now, that's 10% of our request. And a lot of that is both program management of the actual management of the programs themselves, as well as the administration of the grant side of things. We do keep extremely accurate records on all of the programs involved. Because it's such a far-reaching source of funding within the zoo, all of our programs are paying attention to when they're using legacy money versus other funds, and then the ongoing evaluation of the programs themselves. But that is somewhat flexible based on actual funding.
And Mr. Chair, how many people do you employ to do the evaluation and administration? I guess I'm trying to figure out where $450,000 goes, I guess.
That's my question as well, Ms. Proska. So.
Members of the committee, some of that would be in each of the various programs. So if it's the conservation program, some of the staff within the conservation program would use their time on evaluation. Same within education, as well as some of it in the finance department. That's managing the actual management of the funds themselves. I don't have an actual FTE for that particular amount, although I would be delighted to get you one.
And Mr. Chair, I would be very interested in a breakdown of that, because you say it's 10%, but it's more than you spend on the farming heritage.
Other question? And if there are requests like Senator Fischbach's relative to particular parts of your request, if you're going to get back to us, I would ask that you do so relatively quickly. So that's not just to the zoo, to Ms. Prochaska, but to everybody else that will need to get that information back very soon. Other questions from the committee, from the subcommittee? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, and next we have the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Yeah. Well, I think there are. Everybody's here. So I know on the agenda we had Ms. Franks first. Obviously, we have discussion about what's proposed relative to the Ojibwe language. So I don't know who wants to start out or Ms. Franks,
Hi.
Go ahead.
I'm here representing Indian Affairs Council.
Yes.
I'm sending Anna Marie Hill, our executive director's apologies. She can't be here this evening. Her father passed away. So thank you for allowing us to be here and testify on behalf of our council. We appreciate your past support and current consideration for our request for funding for our grant program, plus three of the language immersion schools within the state of Minnesota. We've been a direct recipient of the Arts and Cultural Heritage funding since 2010. We believe, and studies have shown, that language revitalization has the potential to make a positive impact on efforts to bridge the educational achievement gap between Minnesota American Indian students and non-American Indian students. Right now, Senate Bill 1990 is asking for $3 million total, $725,000 each year for language preservation, immersion grants, $250,000 each year for three of the immersion schools, and $50,000 each year for the Dakota and Ojibwe Working Group. And then I'm going to let the experts testify unless Great. There's questions.
And if you can make sure everybody identifies themselves for the record, please.
My name is Melanie Franks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Hope Flanagan in English. What I'm saying is my Indian name is Little Wind Woman, and I'm Turtle. I'm a turtle. That's my clan. And I'm grateful to see that in your title you're honoring cultural heritage, and that we're represented in our seal here. As Ms. Frank was saying here, we know that our children do not perform well educationally when they're compared to their peers. And we've seen that when they can be reminded who they are through their language, through their culture, that we've seen that this is a tool to raise those scores, to improve the children's success rates. First of all, I want to say that I work for Wichoye Nandage Kaindan. Wichoye is Dakota for seeks to learn, and Nandage Kaindan is Ojibwe for it seeks to learn. These are our two major tribal groups here in the state of Minnesota. Wichoye Nandage Kaindan came about as a group of people, mostly elders, sometimes community members, that had no money, nothing, no support, came together and said, we need to save our languages. Our languages are disappearing. These languages are vital resources for the state of Minnesota. These are natural resources, and when they're gone, they're gone. And our first language speakers have that unique way of thinking. It's almost like saying this is a different way to see the world. This is a gift for all Minnesotans, not just those of us who are speakers, but those for all of us, a gift to all of Minnesotans to know this is a different way of looking at the world. I was a teacher for Minneapolis Public Schools for many years, and one of my jobs was to do parent coordination. Parents would come and we'd ask them, what do you want for your children? Above success, above financial success, above academic success, parents said across the board, we want our children to know their language and their heritage. But it's really hard because we don't have many elders anymore that have the language, that know their ways. So our gifts, our precious elders that know the languages, know the ways, we need to make sure that they're able to pass that on, that we can pass on what we know. It's a crucial way of looking at the world in a different manner. What happened years ago when these elders and people from the community came together, they said, what do we need to do? We need to preserve these languages because it's the culture is embedded in the language. So when you learn your language, then you can carry on your culture. You can't do your ceremonies if you don't have your language. You can't carry on your ways if you don't have your way of thinking and seeing the world that's embedded in there. So these people came together, these elders and mostly elderly women. It was a circle of elderly women came together. They came to Representative Karen Clark. They were recognized, and she said, this is an important resource for the state of Minnesota. Let's make sure that we're recognized through the Legacy Act. And that's what happened is we had some elders that were first language speakers. Some of them have passed away since then, and we have very, very few. We have 4 Minnesota Dakota elders that still speak Dakota, which that's all, only 4. Now, some people say we have less than 100 elders that still speak Ojibwe. So these are precious, precious resources. I've been working with Wichoye Nandige Kainden for the last 6 years. I work with the smallest children because that's when the brain connections are being formed. 16 months to 5 years old is when all these verbal skills are being developed. And the language goes through into the brain, and they're starting to learn at that age group when they're first learning any level of language. Well, you might ask, well, what happens then? Because if they're learning in Ojibwe, how is it that they can learn in English? Well, we found out through testing, through Minnesota standardized testing, through IGDIS, through the ASQ-3s, that's the standardized tests that all children receive in preschool, that our children performed above their counterparts in English, because they were learning different ways of operating in the world. With the Wichoye Nandige Kainden program, they came together and created the Dakota Ojibwe Language Revitalization Alliance. And this was an effort to come together to say, these are important ways of being in this state, that we can come together, help each other, and keep the children finding success. So that was part of what we noticed is as the children, now let me backtrack just one moment. When I was working in the Minneapolis Public Schools, I was working at Anishinaabe Academy, and I was seeing that the kids wanted to be able to speak their language. And I saw that as they wanted to learn their language and I could bring it into the classroom, they were happier in the classroom. They had experienced more success in the classroom. So it was my effort thinking, well, gee, I'd rather see this as a full-time thing. So I left Minneapolis Public Schools and came to work for Wichoye Nandige Kainden because I saw the happiness, the joy, the success that those kids were experiencing and those families wanted. If you look at I'm sure all of you have seen the reports that our kids score very low when it comes to standardized testing in the long range. Well, let's close that gap. Let's make the school systems address this in a way where they can see, yes, we honor them. We honor their culture. We honor their language. We honor them as little beings. So that's part of why this is such a valuable and important asset that we can give to all of the people of Minnesota. Myself, personally, in the last 6 years, I've worked with 120 children. We estimate that generally we've worked with 700 children since the Legacy Act started working with our classrooms. We assume that because of our outreach, when we do programs in the community, that over 700 children, we triple that when we're talking about families. What we see as big areas that need to be addressed are curriculum, because there are no books written in the language. Our books that we create are the only books that we have. Teacher training, we have a huge deficit in the number of teachers that are trained to work in the classroom, and we're losing our first language speakers. So those are the 3 areas that we really need to focus on, to have first language speakers come into the classroom that can say, this is how you say it. you've got it close, but turn it around this way, because it's a different way of thinking when you look at how the first language speakers are speaking. We're so thankful now that Bidote is working with the children, because now we don't just have the early childhood program, but we're going beyond that in the immersion setting, because we know that that's the best way to learn a language is in immersion. I want to mention, too, that we also do a teacher sharing event with WeChoEA, but I wanted to just give an example of how things are seen differently in the language. Every year we go to an apple orchard, and the fellow that works at the apple orchard, he says, "We're so glad you come here because you're the only ones that thank the trees. You have to give an offering before you take anything." And the kids know that. They said, "Oh, we can't take an apple before we thank those trees." And we see that every day. I see that. I'm dressed the way I am because we were in the garden today. And so was, I know Brenda was in the garden today. So we're working with those things. And I was working next to this little girl who just turned 3. And I was listening to her singing a traditional song. And she's singing, "I'm thankful for life." That was the song she was singing. And I remember hearing another little girl who was also, she was playing with her in the block area, and she made up a song of, "Help us, help us, help us to learn how to speak Ojibwe." And so she did that 3 years ago. So now every year I teach my other students how to sing that song, because it's a beautiful song. It's a traditional song. When these kids can learn these languages, then they can carry on their ways. And we know that those are the best protective factors for native students. If you want them to succeed, help them to learn their language, help them to learn their ways, and then we're likely to stay away from all those risk factors that put our children and our communities in such peril, as we all know from the media. So, miigwech, that means thank you. Chairman of the board, and thank you, committee members. We're so thankful that you've supported us in the past, and we hope that you continue to support us and maybe increase your support of us, because this is a really valuable effort. Miigwech, that means thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Elaine Salinas, and I'm the chairperson of the Bidote Learning Center Board of Directors. I think in the materials that you have a brochure, as well as some the executive summary from a report that I'm going to reference briefly. I would just like to say that much of what Hope has shared with you, we're also experiencing. Bidote is a new charter school that opened in the fall of 2014. We currently have an enrollment of 60 students in K through third grades. Many of our students are students who came through the preschool program at WeChoEA. We are a unique school in this country because we are the only language immersion school that teaches in two indigenous languages. We teach in both Ojibwe and Dakota. I'm honored to be here today to share information about Bidote with you and to talk a little bit about the needs that we have in the area of language immersion. In 2010, the Minnesota Legislature established a work group to look at Indigenous language revitalization and preservation. And I'm sure many on this committee remember the establishment of that work group. And a report was published in 2011 that basically talked about the status of Minnesota's indigenous languages and made recommendations about what the state needed to do, what tribes needed to do, what the communities needed to do to work together to revitalize and save our languages. As Hope mentioned, that report found at that time, and this was back in 2011, that there were fewer than 100 Ojibwe first speakers and about 5 Dakota first speakers. And as Hope has shared, we've lost one of our Dakota first speakers since that time. In essence, the report found that Minnesota's indigenous languages are in imminent danger of being lost. The report also identified the following critical steps to revitalize and ensure the survival of the languages. Number 1, they talked about long-term support for immersion programs. The many elders that sat as part of that working group told us the only way to save our languages is immersion instruction, and to begin with our very youngest children, since they have the greatest capacity to learn the language. Number two, it was vital that we prepare teachers who are not only proficient in the language, but possess teaching credentials. Third, we need the development of language immersion curriculum that is aligned with Minnesota academic standards. Right now, if we talk to the immersion programs, the school age that serve school age children that have been in operation for some time, we know that it's a daily struggle for teachers. They're trying to develop curriculum at the same time that they're trying to teach children. And we know that oftentimes, because of the burden of doing that, they're not able to align what they're teaching with the Minnesota academic standards. That's a huge challenge. With the financial support of a current grant from the Legacy Fund and other funders, Bidoti is embodying all of these approaches that were, these critical measures that were identified in the report. First of all, we were providing core instruction in Ojibwe and Dakota for 90% of the school day. We work, as Hope mentioned, we work in close cooperation with the preschool program so that the children that are in that program can transition to Bidoti. Before the opening of Bidoti, these children begin to become fluent in the language, and all of a sudden everything would stop. They would go into kindergarten, and it was into a completely English-speaking classroom. Now they have the option of coming to Bidoti to not only to continue their education, which not only ensures that they will retain what they've already learned, but they'll be able to acquire fluency much faster. Second, Bidoti's teachers are largely graduates of the language certificate programs at the University of Minnesota. There's one in Ojibwe and there's one in Dakota. Most have also completed a special program that was offered only for 1 year at the University of St. Thomas that allowed those people who had gained their language credentials, their certificates, to then earn over the course of a year a master's degree in teaching and their elementary teaching certification. That program was designed and developed by an Ojibwe professor at the University of St. Thomas. She since has retired, and that program no longer exists. But we need programs like this. Finally, Bidoti is specifically using a current legacy grant to create a core curriculum, K through 3 core curriculum, in both the Ojibwe and Dakota languages. This is a piece that we've needed for a very long time in order to bolster the opportunities and the offerings that we provide in our immersion programs. We are aligning that curriculum with Minnesota academic standards, and the curriculum is currently being tested at Bidoti as it's being developed, and once it is tested, it will be more broadly shared with language immersion programs across the state of Minnesota. I would just like to say that despite the efforts of Bidoti, Wachohe, and other language programs around the state, we are running out of time. During the past year, we have lost many of our first speakers, and we have lost the knowledge that is critical. And with their passing, we've lost the knowledge that is critical to our language revitalization efforts. We need additional resources to fund greater numbers of immersion programs. We need more people developing immersion curriculum. And we need more teachers that possess both language proficiency and teaching credentials. Finally, this all must be done while our remaining first speakers are here to guide and assist us. It is imperative that we learn from the experiences of other indigenous peoples around the globe. Just this past month, the Menominee Nation of Wisconsin lost its last first speaker. This was a tragic loss not only to the Menominee Nation and people and to the state of Wisconsin, but to people everywhere, since this is the only place in the entire world where the Menominee language was spoken. Minnesota must and can do better. I would like to thank you for this opportunity to address the committee, and we would be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you.
Do you want to go first?
Brenda Imakiapi. My name is Bernadette, or Brenda. I am a first language Dakota, Lakota speaker here in Minnesota, one of the last ones. And I think it is important to try to save the language, revitalize the language. There's not very much of us left, like Elena was saying. There's just a few of us. Also, our kids seem to achieve academically when they go through our program, or the test scores, they go up and we have a higher graduation rate. Let's see what else I was going to say. I think that's pretty much hope, and Elaine covered all the bullet points.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I did want to mention that please understand that this is a very limited effort. We're the only pre-K that's in Ojibwe in the state of Minnesota and in Dakota in the state of Minnesota. So there's not a whole bunch of us out there, and they're the only Dakota in Ojibwe program. So thank you for listening. I certainly appreciate it.
So thank you. And if I can ask a couple of questions. First, are you still working with the Humanities Commission relative to some of this?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we work with the Humanities Commission. We work with them with our teacher sharing event, and we've been in dialogue with them. And currently, they're not our fiscal agent.
Okay. So if I can ask, because you indicated that there was the request for the grants to preserve the language, I think, if I'm quoting you correctly. So can you just give me an example of some of the types of grants made to help the preservation?
I believe that we've had over 47 grants issued from Minnesota Indian Affairs, but I can get an exact number to you.
Well, if you could just give me an idea of some of the kinds of grants made as to what the grant is and to whom it was made and how that's helped with the preservation. Because I know when we looked at first doing this several years ago, you know, there was a lot of discussion about the need to enhance the preservation in addition to teaching the languages. So I just want to get some sense of that.
I'm not too familiar with the program, unfortunately, but I do know that Indian Affairs Council has been receiving the funds and then dispersing the grants since 2010, and I believe that we've issued over 47 grants to different entities. Some of them have received multiple grants over the years for language preservation.
Would it be possible, then, if you could get a list to us
of who's received what? Absolutely.
Yeah, so just to have some, I'm not looking for a treatise of any sort, but just to have some sense of how the grants have been utilized. Because, again, I think when we had this discussion originally, there was the discussion centered on the need for preservation and how some of the grants would help with the preservation. So I'm kind of separating that from the education, and not to suggest that that's not of importance, and the point's been made clearly that in terms of first speakers, there's just a handful left within the state of Minnesota. And so I'm assuming, I think Ms. Flanagan made that point. I think it was Ms. Flanagan, as opposed to Ms. Salinas, that I'm just inferring from that, if we only have a handful of folks within the state of Minnesota, I assume you duplicate that around the country, and you really don't have that many folks, because if we don't have a lot of people here in Minnesota in terms of Dakota and Ojibwe, you know, I'm not sure. You'd have some other states, but not a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So I assume even nationally the number would be pretty limited. So, like I said, if it's possible to take a look at how those, you know, what those grants are, and even if you're not conversant, if somebody else at the council could, somebody
absolutely.
Else on the staff could provide that,
yeah,
that would be helpful.
Absolutely. We'll get that to you.
And then I had a question for Ms. Salinas where you emphasized the particular charter school. I'm not the expert on charter schools and Miss Tate, I don't know why I'm looking at Senator Bonhoff, because she's looking at me. But so are you receiving similar monies to other charter schools?
Yes.
In the state?
Yeah, we had to go through the same process as all of the charter schools. We had to have an authorizer. We're authorized by Innovative Quality Schools, which is one of those, I think, the first single-purpose authorizer for charter schools. We had to submit an affidavit to the Minnesota Department of Education. They had to approve that affidavit, and we were chartered in 2013, and we had a planning year. So we're like other charter schools. We're unique in the work that we're doing, but we are very similar in terms of the same process that all charter schools had to follow to become charter schools we followed.
So the request made relative to some of the immersion programs, again, as Ms. Flanagan cited, in terms of detailing the amount, would that be the portion of the requested grant that would go to your school? Or at least part of that would go for the particular language programs.
Yeah, my understanding is that the request includes a targeted request to the three immersion sites, which would include Wichohe, it would include Negani, which is a language immersion, Ojibwe language immersion school on the Leech Lake Reservation, which is part of Bugganegishik School, and it would include Bedote Learning Center, which is our school.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was along the lines of what I wanted to know. We don't have the request in front of us, unless I'm missing something. I'm assuming we're going to see the request with authors' bills tomorrow night. And so it's difficult to ask questions about what you're going to use the money for because I don't see the request. So can you share with me the dollar amount that is being requested for this purpose?
I have one copy.
Well, you can just tell me.
What's the bill number?
It's 3 million altogether for the 2016-2017 biennium for the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. A is for grants to preserve Dakota and Ojibwe language. $725,000 for the first year and $725,000 for the second year for grants programs that preserve Dakota and Ojibwe Indian language and to foster educational programs in Dakota and Ojibwe languages. B, language immersion. $250,000 for the first year and $250,000 the second year are for grants each year for the Negani Ojibwe Immersion School and the Wichohe Urban Immersion Project and the Bedote Learning Center for a total of $1,500,000 for the 2016-2017 biennium. And C, Dakota and Ojibwe Working Group, $50,000 for the 2016-2017 biennium for the working group. And that is Senate Bill number 1990, author Scoey.
Thank you.
No problem.
And just a comment, I think members are aware, but just so folks here understand, generally with this committee, we appropriate with this part of the fund, in fact, for most of the legacy fund, we appropriate simply in the first year. The exception to that is the Lessard-Sams Council, where they make recommendations to us on a yearly basis. Other questions from the subcommittee? Okay, thank you very much for being here. We still have a number of folks to go through. Let me indicate to members of the subcommittee, the Humanities Commission and the Science Museum have handouts that are included in our packets but are not offering testimony tonight. So the next we have is the Minnesota Civic Education Coalition. So whoever is going to testify. So we've got several people. If you just want to identify yourself and and we do have, as members know, we've had, again, I mentioned the Humanities and Science Museum, so you can tell by the agenda, we still have arts folks, history folks, and public broadcasting folks. So whoever's going to start out, just if you might identify yourself, and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Tracy Wernberg-Lem, and we are members of the Minnesota Civic Education Coalition, which is a group of individuals and organizations that have worked together many years to preserve Minnesota's civic heritage by passing along knowledge, traditions, and responsibilities to the next generation. Civic culture does not just happen. It is not a natural state. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said, "Knowledge of our system of governance and our rights and responsibilities as citizens is not passed along through the gene pool. Each generation of Americans must be taught these basic principles." We find ourselves in challenging times. The civic education need and civic knowledge gap is clear. In a recent Annenberg study conducted in September, the University of Pennsylvania found that only 36% could name all three branches of the U.S. government, and 35% of individuals could not name one. Only 27% of respondents knew that it required two-thirds vote of the House and Senate to override a presidential veto. The director, Kathleen Jamison, said that this survey offers many pieces of dramatic evidence of the need for more and better civics education. Even in Minnesota, where we do enjoy civic culture that is the envy of many, we need to focus time and attention on civic education to address the crisis that is becoming more apparent every day. We all must work together to preserve the civic culture we all hold dear. Through legacy funds, the Civic Education Coalition partners are using over 90 years of collective civic education programming experience to deliver effective programming that is frequently cited as best practices. We know that our programs are effective at building educated, engaged, smart, educated young people. Our coalition creates opportunities for students, we enrich teacher capacities, and we're building statewide networks so that we can scale up our efforts. Each of our coalition partners will describe the work made possible by past legacy funds, and we will each speak briefly about what we hope to do in the future. We have a handout that you should have received that has a lot of information. The left-hand side says what we've done with past ones, and the right-hand side states what we'd like to do moving forward. And in the front, there is a map that gives you a snapshot of the communities we served in the past 2 years. So as you can see, we've done a lot of work, but we still have much to do. Speaking for kids voting, I wanted to just quickly highlight that over 45,000 Minnesota students from over 50 communities had an opportunity to cast a kids' voting ballot. This is an increase of, this more than doubled what we did during the last presidential election in 2012, in which 19,000 students voted. There was 130 high school students, most of whom were Hmong, Somali, Latino, and African American, were trained in ranked choice voting. Kids Voting Minneapolis designed and implemented a new program educating students about the ranked choice voting in partnership with the Minneapolis Public Schools and the Minneapolis City Elections Office. They were trained by a legacy-funded coordinator, school leadership groups, and social studies teachers in 7 schools, and they did outreach with families, neighborhoods, and friends. Over 100,000 coloring books, I voted stickers, ballot boxes, temporary tattoos, and bookmarks were provided to Minnesota students to help support their civic learning. We had 25 lessons that aligned with Minnesota social studies standards that were made available to teachers during election time to really kind of embed the learning about voting. And we had 134 students that learned about voting by casting a ballot for their favorite train during an event we did with the Children's Museum called Civic Saturday. So that was just high. Most of them voted for Thomas, in case you were wondering. So I will pass it on.
Thank you. I'm Orville Lindquist, the Executive Director for Minnesota YMCA Youth and Government. Hopefully all the senators are familiar with youth and government, since we come every January. Kick you out and take over your chamber. We bring students to the Capitol. We run a model United Nations. But we're really focused on putting young people in real-life situations, certainly as it relates to government and issues, but also things that help them grow up to be productive citizens and productive adults when they go to work or to college or whatever they do in their post-high school years. Through legacy funds, we've worked to extend regular youth and government programming. We're already hitting about 2,300 students around the state. We've worked to expand that to put on an issues-based conference every summer. We focused one summer on violence, on college readiness, on discrimination, on some issues related to natural heritage this past summer. And we're getting ready for our conference this coming June, which is focused around the future of health in Minnesotans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Bloom, and I'm the Executive Director of the Learning Law and Democracy Foundation. www.teachingcivics.org would never have happened but for funding from the Legacy Committee. It is a conversation I had many times with the Department of Education, and it seemed to be out of reach of their efforts, their money, their time, their ability, and so with the grant from Legacy, we were able to do it. And today, the impact. In the past year, Minnesotans in 230 cities have joined the effort to preserve our civic culture by accessing resources on the website. 4,978 sessions. That's how many times people came. During each session, users averaged about 3 to 4 lessons or pages that they visited. The total, that's 17,572 pages. Now, if you think that any of these are teachers, you can multiply this by 150 teachers a semester, by 50 teachers a semester. So think about 17,000 pages going to students all over the state. Our biggest cities, our biggest user cities, not surprisingly, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and it's Roseville, North Branch, Shoreview, Forest Lake, St. Cloud, Albany, Cambridge, and Winona. It's not the whole story, though, just to give you the top number of user cities. For example, Laverne's impact, there's only 2 people there who come online and look at materials, but they average 15 pages every time they join us, and they spend about 20 minutes. So we can assume it's someone who's coming, who's thinking about educating kids about our government and civics, and is finding the materials that they want. I know, for example, one particular unit that we wrote about Minnesota voting was downloaded 135 times. Wow. 135 times 150 students is a lot of students. The website connects Minnesotans who care about preserving our civic culture with lessons and resources. And these are materials that have been vetted. If you go out, and we can easily say to teachers, go find lessons on the internet. And they'll go out and they'll find lessons, and there are a lot there. And they'll spend a lot of time finding them and a lot of time reviewing them to see if they're good. Most of the lessons are now created by agenda-driven organizations. They have figured out that if they provide a lesson, and in that lesson they only provide half the story, they get their message across, and it's in a classroom, and it's used for years. And I have multiple pieces of evidence about that I could share with you at any time. We have a team of teachers, experienced teachers and lawyers who help us vet lessons. We invite feedback. So occasionally I'll hear from someone who will say, you know, you should check this lesson because slide 7 isn't correct. We also develop our own materials. The materials on the website might include materials from all sorts of other places, but we also develop our own materials. So in the last 2 years, we've developed materials on the juvenile justice system because the juvenile court judges wanted kids to learn about the justice system, about voting. And in fact, in the voting curriculum I just talked about, in Red Rock Elementary in Woodbury, there is a courageous teacher that used that with 120 fifth graders at one time in the gym, with lots of volunteers to make it happen, and it worked. We are now currently working on one of our more exciting things, and that's an iPhone app. It will also go Android at some point. That will be the Minnesota Constitution. So students who now under the standards have to compare our U.S. Constitution and the Minnesota Constitution will be able to look at an app and see it. They'll be able to look at comparative language. They'll be able to look at Minnesota Supreme Court cases that have interpreted it and compare it with U.S. interpretations. And sometimes the Minnesota Constitution is more generous with protections. And they'll be able to see that. Student programs, we also have We the People and Project Citizen, and those programs involve at least 1,000 students, but I don't even know how many students are involved in the feeder program. May 12th is our annual Project Citizen Day. We've moved it to the Judicial Center, and there you can come and see the students show what they know about how do you solve public problems. They learn about government, they learn about the Constitution, they learn about statistics, they interview people, they study the problems. Our fourth area is supporting a network of teachers, and we've got an expanding leadership network of teachers throughout the state because we know those of us living in the metro area can't get up to Thief River Falls very often to help those teachers. And so our goal is that we will have, under our underserved Each One Reach One effort, we'll be able to maximize the impact. The Minnesota Civic Education Coalition accomplishes our goals not with the staff that you see sitting here, and we are small operations. We do it with a lot of volunteers. And just trying to figure out the volunteers, we had over 1,000 volunteers directly involved in our programs in the last year. And these are Minnesotans who have joined the effort to preserve our democracy. Our goal in the next biennium is to deliberately focus on the areas that aren't blue on the map. Look at the map. We haven't covered it all. Sometimes that means going to these areas and meeting with them in their communities and in their neighborhoods. We need to train in the community. We need to provide funding so they have resources so they can participate. Lots of students would love to come to St. Paul and be part of Project Citizen, but they don't have the funding. So how do we connect them in Thief River Falls with what's going on here in a meaningful way? These are all things we would love to do. In closing, we are very grateful for the past legacy support and know the impact it has had on tens of thousands of young people throughout the state. To increase this impact, we are requesting an increase. I know that this probably doesn't jive with the message, but we're asking for a $50,000 increase, so it'll go from $250,000 a year to $300,000 a year in funding from the state to expand our programs and target underserved communities. Mr. Chair, members of the community, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to just wrap it up with lending my support. I'm Mary Jo McGuire, current Ramsey County Commissioner, but I'm here in my capacity as a board member of Learning Law and Democracy. I've had the privilege of working with and supporting these organizations for all of my life in the legislature and have been privileged to witness their work. They are able to do so much with the very minimal amount that the state is able to provide, and it is really important work. I believe it is crucial to the sustainability of our democracy that we support the efforts of these organizations, and I ask for your support. And I thank you for being here tonight on this evening, hearing from all of these great organizations. So thank you very much, and appreciate it.
Nice to have you back with us.
Thank you. It's great to be back. Great to see you all.
Questions from the subcommittee? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have the Minnesota State Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils. Okay. And let me indicate to members that, you know, tomorrow we're going to hear bills from members, and normally we would hear bills of the non-committee members first. What we'll probably do is we'll hear bills by geography. So if somebody's coming in to as a witness before the subcommittee of some Thank distance you. Away, we'll probably hear those bills first. And then, depending on what we have left, then hear non-committee members' bills. So Ms. Jens, are you starting off?
I am, Mr. Chair.
No, we did not.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sue Jens. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. I did not bring props. I brought people. And I am going to just very quickly tee off our presentation tonight and then hand off to my colleagues. In the interest of time, I won't go through and introduce all of them. I'll ask them to introduce themselves as they speak. First of all, thank you to all of the members of the committee for this chance to give you a very brief overview of our work and its impact. Thank you for the past legacy funds you have invested in the Arts Board. You have a very brief handout with some high-level information about the Arts Board Regional Arts Council system and the ways that we're investing arts and cultural heritage funds. Primarily, the thing to keep in mind is that the reason the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Council system exists is to invest financial resources throughout the state of Minnesota in arts and arts activities. The core business that we are in is the business of stimulating creativity and imagination. So I'm going to ask you to imagine just for a moment. You see six of us at the table tonight, but really we are here. And what I hope you will imagine is standing or sitting next to us and standing around the edges of the room, the hundreds of arts organizations who are using the arts and cultural heritage funds that we invest in them to make their programs more affordable and accessible throughout the state, the hundreds of schools, community centers, nonprofits, human and social service organizations who are using the arts to build academic achievement, increase health and wellness in our communities, and strengthen our communities. Imagine the thousands of artists, actually tens of thousands of artists, who are enlightening, challenging, and inspiring us with their work. The tens of thousands of young people whose talents are nurtured, creativity is developed, and who walk a little taller in the world because their sense of self has been strengthened. And imagine the millions of people who participate in the activities that we're funding. If we brought them all here, they wouldn't fit in this room. Indeed, they would not fit in the building. So we represent a system that invests in the arts across the entire state of Minnesota. We're not investing in a single community or a single region. We're not investing in a single art form or a single targeted group. But we try to find a balance to meet the highest priorities and the needs of Minnesotans and also invest in their aspirations and opportunities. I am going to draw your attention just to two or three things that are in your handout. On the fourth page of the handout, there's information about the previous arts and cultural heritage funding we have received. And I think the key information on that fourth page is at the bottom of the page. You'll see an overview of the kinds of funding or the volume of funding requests and grants that we have made over the past. We as a system receive about 7,500 grant applications a year. We make just over around 4,500 grants per year. The number on this page that I think is really very important is that in a biennium, we receive as a system $90 million to $100 million of requests. We are able to meet just over half of those. So the demand for the kind of support that we can provide is tremendous. The last number that I will draw your attention to and then hand off to my colleagues is on the last page of the handout, page 5, in the text box. In the 2012-2013 biennium, the programs that we funded, the Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils together, served a combined audience of 24.1 million people. More than four times the state's population. So you can rest assured that the funds that you have invested us in the past, and we hope that you will invest in us this year, have a significant impact and they reach broadly throughout the state. I will finish. I will stay at the table for questions if you have them, but I'm going to hand off to my colleague. And as we go down the table, I'll ask him to introduce himself.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Maxine Adams. I'm the executive director of the Lake Region Arts Council. I am here on behalf of that arts council, but also the 10 other regional arts councils in the state. The regional arts councils are your partner on the most basic grassroots level of distributing funding from the state legislature to support arts activities to the citizens and your constituents in Minnesota. My purpose here tonight is to help you put a face and a story to the grants that are given out from the regional arts councils. To do that, I have brought storyboards with me with photos. I will try and keep it very, very brief because I'm sure that you're beginning to feel this is a very long evening for you. I've brought three grants tonight. One is a public art grant. One is a city legacy grant. And the other is a school residency. Hopefully, as I tell their stories, you will keep in mind that throughout the state, these activities are being replicated over and over and over again in all of the regional arts councils. The first grant that I would like to share with you is the Alexandria Maritime Art Alexandria Maritime Museum. They asked for and received a grant from the Lake Region Arts Council to build a sculptural art-designed gate to their public arts garden. The Maritime Museum in Alexandria receives thousands of visitors throughout the year. Their public arts garden is used for weddings, receptions, and for people just to come and view beautiful landscaping and artwork. What you see here is a design that was done by a local metal sculptor that incorporates many of the things that are unique about that area in Alexandria, which is Lake Country. It has the water waves and the sailboat and the pine trees. This is, you probably can't see it, but a closer shot of the gardens. This grant has impacted well over 2,000 people since it started. The second one I want to share with you is one we're especially proud of. This is the city grant for Battle Lake. The city of Battle Lake applied to us for the opportunity to take advantage of their Minnesota Department of Transportation activity this past summer of widening Highway 78. They understood that this was a rare opportunity to incorporate public art into their amenity areas that they opened up. What they did was decided that they wanted to build planters and benches for public use that incorporated glass mosaics. Here you see a large snapshot of a few of the 133 people of the community that volunteered to put those glass mosaics together. They also had metal sculptures incorporated into the planters and benches. This project, I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Battle Lake, but it's very much a tourist town. The population almost triples in the summertime. So they have many, many people going through here viewing the art, but it's also everybody that drives north on Highway 78 sees the planters and the benches. This is also a project that has received a lot of attention. And last, I wanted to bring your attention to one of the programs where we work in the school systems. This is a picture of the Copper Street Brass Quintet, which is a music group that's based in Minneapolis that goes out and does educational programs in schools. This particular grant was for the Alexandria Area High School. The band came in, worked with the students, practiced with them, taught them about composition, about different types of music appreciation, worked with the high school and junior high bands to present a performance for the community in the evening. This probably is the only chance that the high school band has had to perform with professional artists of this caliber for their parents in the community. Again, many, many people reached with this type of program. Finally, I would like to tell you that we are, Lake Region Arts Council, will be having our Spring Legacy Grant Round next Tuesday. We are going to be looking at a record number of grants. There will be 42 grant applications we'll be considering. Our largest grant round up until this has been 31. There is an extreme amount of interest from the public in applying for these grants. I also wanted to let you know, and I carry this message from the board of the Lake Region Arts Council, that they take their jobs as stewards of this funding very, very seriously. They are made up of Minnesota taxpayers. They are our neighbors, our friends. On our board, there are teachers, there are artists, there are a pastor, a retired business owner, farmers. These are the people of Minnesota that are making the decisions about where these funds are going. And again, they take their job very, very seriously. So hopefully I have helped to put a little bit more of a personal face on the grants that are being awarded. Last year we reached the $1 million mark just in our Arts Council alone of funding through legacy grants. I think the ending question that we all hope to have answered is, are the legacy funds accomplishing what the amendment set out to do? I think that's a resounding yes, not only for the Lake Region Arts Council, but for the state and the State Arts Board as part of that system. And I will pass that on then to the next person.
Before that, I apologize for, for interrupting the middle, but I just want to make sure, if I could ask both Ms. Jens and Ms. Adams, the distinction relative to the Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils and what the division is in terms of a grantee on the part of, again, either the Arts Board or the Regional Arts Councils.
I'll give it my best shot. The difference for us is for project grants. Generally, a grantee will come to their Regional Arts Council first. If they are looking at doing something that would incorporate more than one Regional Arts Council or have something on a statewide level like a festival or a touring grant that they wanted to do or something that was uniquely appropriate to the State Arts Board, then they would go to the State Arts Board for funding. Anything that you wanted to add to that, Sue?
Well, because I thought there was, isn't there a distinction between a certain level of arts organizations where larger organizations are within the Arts Board and smaller and maybe startup organizations are within the Regional Arts Councils? Is that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. When the Regional Arts Council system was created 40-some years ago, the idea, pardon me, the idea was that the Regional Arts Councils would be very focused on local arts development, helping new activities start up, helping young organizations grow and develop, and that smaller activities, smaller organizations, perhaps organizations that don't have a professional staff, all volunteer activities might be funded at the Regional Arts Council level, and then once they get to be larger, once they have more infrastructure and perhaps larger budgets, then they would start coming to the Arts Board for funding. And what you're specifically referring to, Mr. Chair, is that we provide general support to about 160 arts organizations that really form, I would say, the backbone of the arts community in Minnesota. And the floor that an organization must have as an annual budget is $166,000. And then it goes up as high as our friends from the Minnesota Orchestra who are here who have a tens of millions of dollar budget each year.
So Ms. Adams, so you'd be looking at organizations with an operating budget of that under that dividing line of 166, is that correct?
For general or operating support, yes. We are looking at doing some legacy grants to part of the ecology of organizations in rural Minnesota, at least in our area, there's only one or two that go above that $166,000. They are eligible to apply to us for project types of grants that would be legacy funded, but not for operating support, which is what Sue just talked about.
So at least with that division, the only place a smaller organization could go if they're from Bowabic or whatever would be through the particular Regional Arts Council.
More than likely, yes.
And last question. In the handout, there's a reference to in the fiscal years 12-13 of about 4,500 grants. Is that the combination of Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay, and is that 4,500 individual organizations, or I think, aren't there some multiple grants made?
Mr. Chair, that's accurate. That is the distinct number of grants. It's not the distinct number of grantees. So there are a few organizations, or there are some organizations that can receive more than one.
So I think I know the answer to this question, but I think there's always, not always, but I think on the part of some folks in the legislature, there's a sense that there's one big group called art or arts. But how many organizations get grants through either the Arts Board or the Regional Arts Council?
Well, in our region, there are about 30 organizations.
Yeah, you mentioned that, but Ms. Jens, do you have the overall figure?
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to think if I have that number in my head. I don't believe that I do. I would speculate when I think about the number of grants across the state that are awarded, about 4,500 in a biennium, 2,000 in a year, I would say that probably 80% of those are distinct organizations. And so I don't do math very well in my head. And I shouldn't speculate. I'm happy to get you that number.
Okay, possibly you could. But so 80% of, in 2014, 2240 would be about 1,600 organizations. Is that
roughly,
correct?
Yes.
Maybe you could get us the number, maybe break it down, not by individual regions, but by the difference between the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils. And maybe if you could get that to us this week, that'd be helpful.
We'll do that. Yes, sir.
Okay. Senator Bonner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Gens, could you remind us, did you make a change in your policy where now there's a limit on what you will give in any one funding year? If I recall, wasn't it that $1 million cap?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, we did for a year put a cap in place in one grant program, and again, that's that general funding program. Since then, we have decided to lift the cap, and we no longer have that.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Gens, so when did you make that change?
We made the change, I believe it was last fall, that our board voted to remove that cap. And so for the fiscal year 16 year that we are just about to start awarding funds for, there will not be a cap in
Thank
that
you.
Grant program.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, maybe fiscal can help us out here, but for fiscal year 2014-15, 15 is not on here. Can we just assume that, 14 is 50% of it, roughly? Do you know?
Chair, Senator, I do not know off the top of my head.
Ms. Jens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, you can assume that because the legacy appropriation is roughly the same for fiscal year 14 and fiscal year 15. But because fiscal 15 is not yet done, as Ms. Adams said, they're still in the process of awarding some of their funds, and that's true for other regional arts councils. We won't have a complete set of data for fiscal 15 until after the end of the fiscal year.
Thank you. So, and a follow-up, Mr. Chair, if I could, what percentage of the asks are not actually accomplished? In other words, that fall back to the bottom line. I know each legacy division or area has a certain amount of grants that are not, you know, they apply for the grant, they get it, and then all of a sudden, oh, sorry, we're not going to be able to do it, so it falls back to the bottom line. Do you have any idea?
I see. Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, from the Arts Board, we have maybe less than 10 grants in a year that for some reason cannot be fulfilled, and if they are able to return those funds or let us know that they can't do the project early enough in the year, we will regrant those funds so that they can still be used. And the committee may recall that with legacy funds, in the past appropriations bills, you have said that the funds are available for the full next year, so that if some of the money does come back, we do try to make sure that it goes out to someone else and that they can use those funds.
And Mr. Chair, members, if you get a chance, and when we do, I assume maybe tomorrow we'll take a look, we'll see the list. That was astounding to me when the arts folks came into my office and showed me a list of my local towns and our area, Lake Region area, that were granted anywhere from, you know, $900 to $2,000 grants for these small towns is a big deal, and it will. Certainly amaze you, especially in rural Minnesota. I had no idea, and I've explained it to you a couple of times. So
if that's a request, Senator Ingebrigtsen, because I'm not sure we would see it tomorrow. Ms. Jens, I don't know what work it might take to provide that to subcommittee members, if that's available in your office, and if you have that information coming to you from the regions as well.
Mr. Chair, we will get that information to you as quickly as we can.
And it's not, and what Senator Ingebrigtsen office is referring to is particularly the support coming from the regions to the smaller organizations, I would guess, throughout the state. So I'm sorry, I kind of interrupted the folks who come here to testify. So,
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am Chris Wittes. I am the managing director for Penumbra Theater. Penumbra was founded in 1976 and remains Minnesota's only professional African-American theater. our commitment to authentic and truthful representations of the African-American experience defines the art we develop and produce, driving our education programs to provide rigorous cultural and historical scholarship while creating an entry point for everyone. Locally and nationally, Penumbra has been leading challenging conversations on racism and equity. We use the power of theater to recognize ourselves in someone who seems, on the surface, so very different. It opens hearts, it changes minds, it brings people together, it moves communities forward. Our programming creates safe places for artists and the public to engage in this difficult but necessary conversation. Our artists are trained as facilitators for the Penumbra Race Workshops, the Art for Social Change programs, and our nationally recognized Summer Institute program. Here with me today is one such artist, H. Adam Harris. And H. Adam is an actor and a teacher that you probably have seen at the Guthrie, at Penumbra, at the Children's Theater, 10,000 Things, among others. He's going to share with you tonight some examples of the impact we have with artists and students.
Okay. Mr. Harris.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is H. Adam Harris. I'm the Teen Programs Coordinator and Lead Teaching Artist of Penumbra Theater Company. Each season in our Art for Social Change workshops examining race and social justice, we reach just about 900 students a year across the metro area. Just this morning, I led a workshop at a Minneapolis high school. There was a young girl there who listened and participated, but she seemed hesitant about the topic and the work. Finally, at the end, just before I left, she caught up to me. "Thank you," she said. "Thank you for letting me know it's okay to be myself." Through our work, we encourage students and adults to be all of who they are, to be themselves. This is very evident in our race workshop. At the core of this workshop are the stories shared by professional artists. One of those stories is that of George. George is biracial, and she was born 1 year after the landmark Loving versus Virginia court case. She is named after her grandfather, a Creek Indian African-American man whom she loved deeply growing up. She is his namesake and was the apple of his eye. But growing up, she didn't think of herself as African-American. She was light and believed she was just German. But one day, at school, a little boy called her the N-word. She was confused and began to think about her race in a new way, searching for what made her black in this boy's eyes. A few years later, a friend, upon seeing a photo of George's mother and grandfather, said, "Hey, who's that black guy with your mom?" And George, out of shame and out of fear of being labeled that word again, said, "I don't know, just some guy." She denied her grandfather the reason for her blackness, and the memory still haunts her to this day. Every time she shares that story, in classrooms, boardrooms, or community centers, people connect with her and begin to share their own stories. They become storytellers and realize that all of us have stories that we could tell. For a lot of us, that very first experience with race comes when we are young, which is why Penumbra has created the Summer Institute. I want to share with you a statement from Nick T., one of our former students, in his own words. "I'm 17, and I've been a Summer Institute student for 3 years. Over that time, I've grown as an artist and as a person. 2 years ago, one of my best friends was shot and killed. Even though I was devastated, Summer Institute helped me to direct my emotions toward raising awareness about gang violence. That summer, I created a performance project using crump, a style of hip-hop movement that releases anger, aggression, and frustration in a nonviolent way. I performed in a solo show at my school for 100 of my peers and teachers to raise awareness. When I first walked through the doors at Penumbra Theater, I had no idea it would become a second home for me and that the people I met at Summer Institute would become like a family. I can honestly say that the program saved my life. When I joined, I was a shy kid who felt hopeless about all the pain I was seeing in my community. Today, I'm a leader, and I'm working every day for change." That's from Nick. As a former intern in the Summer Institute and currently the program manager, I say thank you.
Okay. And if I can, if members will allow me just a question to comment, Ms. Wittes, am I correct? You mentioned that Penumbra is the largest African American theater in the state. Isn't it correct that's possibly the largest in the country?
Mr. Chairman, that is true. We're just shy of 2 million large, and so it's both with pride and shock that we are the largest and considered the preeminent African American theater.
So, if members will allow me a comment, just and I think this predates not only I think Ms. Wittes and Mr. Harris, but I think predates everybody on the committee except Senator Stumpf. I think members are aware that I've had some involvement with art stuff in this place. That's not a surprise to anybody if I mention that. But when we started it, to kind of build up some sense of this, pre-ethics law, we had some events at several arts organizations where you'd have a dinner, a ticket, and an hour of substance in between. And we had an event at Penumbra, which was with, I think it was maybe 2 months after August Wilson got his second Pulitzer. And so it was after session, and so both Mr. Wilson and Lou Bellamy spoke to all of us. And again, it was within a couple months after he got his Pulitzer. And then there was a production of Fences, which was, I think, directed by Mr. Bellamy, and he also had the lead role. So it was kind of interesting to have somebody like that. I think 2 months after that, and to be honest, we had a Senate resolution for August Wilson for the Pulitzer, and which apparently he was, I'm told, very touched by, but within a couple months after that, he announced he was leaving St. Paul. So I think I kind of assumed I had the blame for, you know, having him leave St. Paul. So I don't know if Senator Stumpf, you were there or not, but we had, I think, something like 125 legislators that particular evening. So just an aside. So thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Roma Duncan, and I'm the piccolo player in the Minnesota Orchestra. I'm also currently the chair of our Minnesota Orchestra Members Committee, which is the committee that represents the musicians within the organization. First and foremost, thank you so much. This year, the Minnesota State Arts Board and Legacy Funding provided support for more than 90 Minnesota Orchestra concerts and related operations. Our week-long residency in Bemidji, and our Upbeat program, which provides low-cost tickets and busing to grade school students from Minneapolis and Anoka-Ramsey. The community the orchestra serves annually includes the 350,000 audience members who attend our concerts and education programs, 50,000 of whom are grade school and high school students, and the nearly 1 million people throughout the region who listen to our Friday night NPR broadcasts, and the nearly 25,000 people in the following communities that we have visited or will visit this season: Hibbing, Bemidji, Plymouth, and Winona. As a prominent Minnesota major arts organization, we are representing the value Minnesotans place on vigorous cultural life for our state's citizens. We also represent Minnesota far beyond. We're very excited that in 1 month, we will be the first American orchestra to visit Cuba after the beginning of the normalization of relations with that country. We are taking 100 musicians and significantly more than a dozen members of the press, including Star Tribune, The New York Times, NPR, and KSTP, will be traveling with us to report on this historic tour. Notably, our first the first Minnesota Orchestra International Tour took place in 1929, and it was to Cuba. And next spring, we will play in Carnegie Hall as part of their 125th anniversary celebration. In 2014, we won a Grammy for Best Orchestral Performance, and we couldn't have accomplished all of these things without the support of the people of the state of Minnesota. With your help, we will continue to provide the artistic excellence that you, the rest of the country, and indeed the rest of the world have come to expect from the Minnesota Orchestra. We thank you for supporting the quality of life in this great state by funding the arts, which fill our lives with inspiration, solace, entertainment, and beauty. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Excuse me. My name is Kevin Smith, and I am the president and CEO of the Minnesota Orchestra. Thank you for allowing me to testify tonight along with others. I want to begin by saying that having Roma Duncan here as a member and representative of this organization is significant in the sense that we are an orchestra. The vast majority of our employees and, in fact, our most valuable human resource are the orchestra members themselves. I've only been with the orchestra really for less than a year, and I can say a couple things. First of all, I think that as a resource, we've just begun to understand what Roma and her colleagues constitute, both individually and collectively, as an artistic resource in this community. And the community being the broad community of the state of Minnesota. Basically, we are the largest resident ensemble of professional performers in the state that I'm aware of. There may be a larger one. We basically are a big organization. We are $30 million. More than half of that goes to just the artists themselves, including our music director, our musicians, visiting artists, and whatever. And what this means is that we are part of, we have built since 1903 in this organization, we've become a part of what is a world-class arts community in the state of Minnesota. Just one brief comment about, that relates to the Cuba trip. There is no embassy yet in Havana. There will be, and there's a chance that it might happen when we visit 1 week, 1 month from today. There is an interest section, and the interest section is where the American diplomatic corps resides. And when we sought to go to Cuba, we found out very quickly that we were one of many major American orchestras that aspired to be the first orchestra there after President Obama announced a normalization process with Cuba. We were the kind of the underdogs because there were some very major orchestras involved, and we won. We kind of beat a couple others by about 24 hours, quite honestly. And in talking with the staff at the interest section, they commented that how pleased they were that Minnesota Orchestra, among these other orchestras, was actually won the prize to be first there. And what they said is that, you know, most people internationally and certainly in Cuba think of the United States as what's on the West Coast and what's on the East Coast, and they don't think of a lot in between. And the idea of having Minnesota represented was, to them, really emblematic of the breadth and texture and depth of the arts in this country. Minnesota is not just a leading state. We are a regional arts leader. And once again, we're proud to be a part of that cultural legacy. And moving forward, I think you will see not only at the Minnesota Orchestra, but throughout the arts community, you will see an ever innovating, evolving arts infrastructure that is really going to serve this state even better and more profoundly than it has in the past. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions from the subcommittee? Just a question, I know, either for Ms. Duncan or Mr. Smith. Is the orchestral, do you still have something similar to the adaptive school program or something comparable?
In terms of adaptive school program, we work, well, first of all, we provide in-class learning and concert experience for every elementary school child in Ramsey, Minneapolis, Anoka, Hennepin counties, and beyond that. As far as adopting a school, basically what we've done is adopt several school systems. And once again, we're working directly with them, with artists in the schools, pre-concert curriculum, and then a post-concert assessment. But we get to every, at least one grade level in all of these schools every year.
Okay. I think I was using the name that I remember from X number of years ago. So, are you participating in that then?
I'm not at this time, but I know what you're referring to, the specific program called Adopt a School, where a musician would identify with the school and would go maybe
6 to 10 times over the course of a year. I was never a leader in that, but I went sometimes as a guest. The way it functioned was one musician would go every month or two to a school, and they would invite other musicians. It would usually be two people who went. And I'm honestly not sure if that particular program is continuing in exactly the same form. We would have to check.
No, it's not.
Okay. All right, thanks. Other questions
for the comment?
Sir Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's so inspiring to hear about the Cuba trip. I was not aware of that. Just want to thank you for all that you do, everybody at the table, each your organizations. That was a very inspiring story about Nick and what you shared. And I just wanted you to know that music in Plymouth is a highlight of the year in our community. When the Minnesota Orchestra comes, usually a couple days before the 4th of July, plays just amazing music for the whole community, and then it's finished with obviously, you know, extraordinary fireworks that the orchestra actually plays accompanying the fireworks. So it's really remarkable. Thank you.
Other questions from subcommittee members? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And, okay, then we've got the Minnesota Historical Society.
It's at this big amphitheater. Yes, no.
Next on the agenda is the number 8, history expenditures. Mr. Kelly and panel. Thank you for coming.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about history legacy initiatives tonight. And thank you to members of the subcommittee, the legislature, and importantly, the people of Minnesota for giving the Minnesota Historical Society and hundreds of history organizations the opportunity to preserve Minnesota's history for future generations. Our mission is to use the power of history to transform lives. And we and the hundreds of heritage organizations doing history work statewide do this by preserving, sharing, and connecting. Minnesota's history community has been able to accomplish a great deal. Legacy funds have been granted to over 625 organizations in all 87 counties and have had significant economic benefit. As funds are distributed around the state, local contractors and vendors are sharing the benefits. There is, understandably, very strong applicant demand for legacy funding, and we expect that to continue. I believe you have substantial information in hand. We'll try to be concise tonight. David Kelleher will walk you through how the funding structure has been set up in the past three biennia, and we'll hear briefly from colleagues and participants who have been involved with various legacy programs, and then we'll look to the future.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society, and I'll just take a quick moment to explain a couple of things you have in your folders. This booklet is a compilation of all the legacy expenditures that have happened over the past year, including each and every grant that has gone across the state to all 87 counties. In each corner of the state. The legacy appropriations for history have been divided basically into five areas. One is grants, as I mentioned a second ago, statewide programs that are primarily operated by the Minnesota Historical Society. There's a partnership category to allow history-related organizations to work together to share resources, whether that's intellectual resources or financial resources. There's a fourth category, archaeological survey, and then finally the Minnesota Digital Library. The other document that's in your folder is a document that looks like this, one-pager, and that's a document that was compiled by the Minnesota History Coalition. That's a sort of loose-knit group of history-related organizations that has brought forward this request on behalf of all the folks doing history in Minnesota. It's made up of about a dozen organizations that represent a broad spectrum of disciplines ranging from archaeology, genealogy, I'm going to forget a few, but a whole bunch of other history-related work that we do. And again, in the interest of time, I will leave it at that and then leave some time for questions. And some of our colleagues who have carried out this work from other organizations want to share their experience with legacy funds with you tonight. So
thank you, Mr. Kelly. Who would like to be next? Please identify yourself.
I go first.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Valerie Horton. I am the director of Minitex, which manages the Minnesota Digital Library. I want to thank you for the chance to talk to you about a program I love and am passionate about. The Minnesota Digital Library is a collection of maps, photographs, diaries, oral histories, and many other objects that capture and preserve Minnesota's history. It's made up of digital objects that have been captured by 160 cultural heritage organizations and libraries. That includes large organizations like the University of Minnesota, St. Paul Public Library, regional organizations like the Iron Range Research Center, the Otter Tail History Museum and History Center, but also really interesting organizations such as the Northfield Public Library, the Yacht Museum, and the Girl Scouts. We capture and preserve these items and want to thank you for your assistance in providing these collections to the researchers and history students in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Horton. Please identify yourself. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Doug Gasick, and I'm the Executive Director of the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. And at the Preservation Alliance, we're all about leading and inspiring people to connect to historic places to ensure that our communities stay vital. Legacy has really helped inspire some innovative programming at the Preservation Alliance over the last couple years, specifically our new education program that launched just 10 months ago. We've developed a regional presence in southeastern Minnesota, and we also have developed or had Minnesota Main Street reemerge with using legacy funding. The partnership grants have really proved instrumental in the development of these unique collaborations among organizations throughout the state that are going to have a lasting impact. The education program that I mentioned is really working to broaden and deepen the knowledge base of preservation education in Minnesota, and to inspire people to actually take action with that education, because we believe that education for education's sake just isn't enough. We want people to actually take back and employ what they learned in our classes. So we have a homeowner series that we teach people how to repair their wood windows or to repair plaster in their homes, or we have a handyman 101 or just how to find a good contractor for your historic place. Each class is sold out so far that we put on, so that's really showing the demand that is out there. And then we're doing 6 months follow-ups because that inspiring people to take action is really important for us. And over 80% of the respondents so far have said that they've actually put in their education to use. So people are repairing their wood windows, weather stripping their windows or doors, or replacing trim in their homes. So we're actually seeing people take action with it. The other thing that we've developed with in our education series is a realtor program where we're giving a new certification called Old Home Certified to Realtors. And that just launched about 6 months ago. And we believe that realtors are really at the front lines and provide a lot of important information to people that are just going in and buying historic properties. So we're trying to arm them with the knowledge to really communicate the benefits of old homes to their buyers and then help the new owners make informed decisions about their historic places. Lastly, I'm just going to touch on our Minnesota Main Street, which is an asset-based community and economic development strategy. And we believe that the main assets in a community are the buildings and its people. And the people really cut, and we have 30 associate-level communities in Minnesota and 6 designated communities throughout the state. In just the 4 years that that program has been established, over 23,000 volunteer hours have been logged in just the 6 designated communities. And also in those 6 communities, 63 new small businesses were created in Main Street. And we believe that's at the core of what we do, connecting people to these historic places and connecting people to each other. So we're really happy to be a part of This program, Building Our Relationship and Partnerships with the Minnesota Historical Society and the entire History Coalition. Thank you.
So if I could ask you mentioned the list of contractors that actually work on historic sites. Is there quite an extensive group of them in the state of Minnesota? I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, it's growing. And we're trying to connect people to those historic contractors. That's actually something that we're looking forward to in the future, is figuring out how to do more training in the trades for preservation-related projects, which we feel is really important and actually ties in really well with the work that Rolf is going to be talking about probably.
Yeah, I think we walk by it every day coming and going in the building here. I mean,
we're
kind of astounded about the amount of work that can be done in preserving the beautiful place in which we sit today. So it's really quite an art, actually.
Yeah.
Who's next, please?
Hello, my name is Marone Melikin, and I am currently a research assistant at the Historical Society, but my first connection to the Historical Society as a whole was as a senior in college. I'm a recent graduate of the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and I was a part of the Historical Society Fellows Program during 2014. And being a part of the program itself opened up a lot of opportunities for me that I wouldn't have seen otherwise. Oftentimes, you don't see many individuals like myself that are in the museum world as a whole. And so the fellowship that I received through the Historical Society allowed me to travel to Washington, D.C., and essentially do research within diversity and inclusion and equity within the museum world. It allowed me to present an original diversity profile dashboard before the society and staff, and recently landed the position that I have right now within the education division as a paid research assistant. So it essentially provided a gateway for me to have an opportunity within the society that I wouldn't have even imagined during my senior year of college. And essentially, the program itself harbors just a sense of relationship and community within the society and continues to just perpetuate this notion of bring in young people and bring them in order to sustain them and have them eventually become museum professionals. And so I would really appreciate it, and I know that the many people that were a part of my cohort as well would know that securing these funds for the fellowship as well as the other opportunities that we've received would mean a great deal to many of us. In addition, the funds help programs that we've all been involved in as well, including the History Day program, in which I just came today from working with many students that are off to their state competition and hopes to go into nationals. In schools, I was working in North Minneapolis today, and it is nothing that they would have imagined otherwise. And so these funds tell people that they're a part of the state of Minnesota, that they are recognized within the state of Minnesota, and that they are making history within the state as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hagberg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Rolf Hagberg. I'm the executive director of Northern Bedrock Historic Preservation Corps. The Historic Preservation Corps has come out of a need of two different converging models or situations. One is that there's a tremendous growing inventory of maintenance and repair that needs to happen with historic structures. And the other is that there's a diminishing pool of crafts and tradespeople that really know and understand these, and there's an interest to get young people involved in the preservation trades, to help them learn trade skills. We're working with unions to try and create a pre-apprenticeship program so that we can find young people that want to work with their hands and want to partner up and learn these skills. We're using a Conservation Corps model, which has its roots back in the Civilian Conservation Corps in the WPA days, where we will have crews that will last for 3 to 5 months. They'll work on a variety of different projects, learn a variety of skills, and have trainings from different specialists We're working with the Historical Society and all of the historic preservation people to make sure that we do these to the Secretary of Interior standards at the very highest quality and work with the young people. So it's very exciting. We had a pilot demonstration crew this fall. The brochure that you have in front of you, that's one of our crews out working on a barn in western Minnesota. We also did a lot of cemetery work. The state archaeologist feels that there's over 1,000 abandoned and neglected cemeteries that all need attention and survey work and a variety of things done to them. So we're real excited. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The WPA days, now that's a term that's used, well, not quite often, but often enough to get the curiosity of what era was that?
Well, it was the Works Progress Administration. Yep. It was one of President Roosevelt's alphabet soup programs, they called them. They did a lot of different construction. In fact, on a personal note, one of the things that is powerful for me is my father was in the WPA in South Minneapolis, and he mixed mud and carried it to the bricklayers that laid the brick in the Michael Dowling Pool, which was a big event. I think President Roosevelt came when they opened the Michael Dowling Pool, which is for polio victims. And he said that was one of the most powerful things in his life, was as a young boy to go and work with those men and learn how to work, and it established a work ethic in him, and of which he helped me to establish a work ethic. And every time he'd show up at any house I'd have or building I'd have, he'd have his little box of masonry tools, and we'd putz on that building. So it was, so the WPA built a lot of structures. The Civilian Conservation Corps did, but there are many other historic structures that really need this maintenance and repair. And there's the ability that we'll have through the Conservation Corps model is to get young people excited and immersed in it for a longer period of time, and then help them move on into the preservation trades and work world.
So. Thank you to the testifiers. Committee members, any questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next will be number 9 on the agenda, public television, Bill Trushinsky and Terry O'Reilly, I believe. That's not going to be handed out tonight, is it?
No.
Okay. All right. Just
unfortunately, these awards don't belong to the recipients. They actually belong to the Academy.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you
please
very much.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bill Strusinski, and I represent the Friends of Minnesota Public Television. And thank you for this opportunity to be here tonight. We've done good work, and we've certainly have appreciated the investment you all have made in us over the last several years in public television, and certainly we want to thank the citizens of Minnesota. This is our annual report, which we present to the legislature each year. You did not get a hard copy, everybody, but it's available online, and I mean, certainly can make a hard copy for you, but it's 112 pages of what each of the 6 public television stations did in the past year with respect to legacy. Talks about their diversity efforts. It talks about how much money they spent on programs and the kinds of programs and the artists we featured. Public television, basically, this initiative for all of us, we think we fulfill the constitutional requirement of educating the public on arts and allowing people to participate in the arts in unique ways and to educate the public on our history and cultural heritage. And I'm basically, Mr. Chairman, going to turn it over to Mr. O'Reilly, who is representing the Public Television Association tonight.
Thank Terry. You, Mr. O'Reilly.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good evening, and thank you for your
for your stamina this evening. My name is Terry O'Reilly. I'm the Chief Content Officer and Senior Vice President at Twin Cities Public Television, and I appear tonight on behalf of the Minnesota Public Television Association, which is an organization comprised of the state's six independent public television stations, each of whom provides a unique and essential service to their local community. Every day we reach and serve more people than any other nonprofit in the state of Minnesota. Together, our broadcast signals blanket the state of Minnesota. Our members include WDSE and WRPT in Duluth, Lakeland Public Television in Bemidji, Prairie Public Television in Fargo-Moorhead, Pioneer Public Television in Appleton, KSMQ in Austin, and TPT here in St. Paul and Minneapolis. I'm here to talk today on the work done by the stations of the MPTA over the past biennium with funding from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and to request your continued support of that work, sustaining positive, creative economic impact that it's had for our state's artists and for our artistic communities, maintaining our continued ability to curate, capture, and share the arts and cultural heritage of the state, and build a bountiful archive of arts, history, and culture that will serve as an educational and civic asset for generations to come. The MPTA is making great strides in our arts and heritage funding work. In the past 2 years, we have produced programming featuring more than 5,000 artists and experts. We have worked with nearly 3,000 partners and collaborators. We have broadcast more than 4,000 hours of legacy-funded cultural history and arts programming with an estimated total viewership in excess of 7 million viewers, and that is a substantial increase over what we were able to provide in the preceding biennium. And there have been more than 3 million views of these same media assets online. We're also proud of the fact that the quality of our work does not go unnoticed. This Emmy Award that I've brought with me tonight is one of more than three dozen that have been awarded to MPTA producers, videographers, editors, and other staffers across the state of Minnesota in the past 5 years in recognition of legacy-funded work. This is the television industry's most prestigious award. It speaks to the quality of the work that is being done by the 40-plus full-time staffers who are attached to our work and the more than 300 freelance shifts that occur. It is also an award that we share with all of the Minnesotans who make this work possible. I'd like to share a post that actually came off our Facebook page last night for our legacy-funded Minnesota original show. It honors us by saying that, quote, CBS Sunday Morning stumbles by comparison. But notably, it calls out the partner artists and organizations who benefit from the work that we're doing. For the coming biennium, we're proposing a continuation of the work that we have been doing for the past 5 years, and on that basis requesting $8.4 million in legacy funding. It's important to note that the support of our work is not just important because of how it's used today, but rather how it will be used in the future. Today we can go to the library and pick up a book that was written 100 years ago and learn about what life was like then. A century from now, someone will go to a 22nd century library, undoubtedly use a technology that we can't even envision right now, and they will find a robust collection of Minnesota's arts, culture, and history, thanks to your support of public television. With your permission, I'd like to share a short video to give you a sample of the work we do and the impact we have with your support.
One artist at work in a studio, or a group of artists working together, united around one idea, creating a piece of art out of nothing, working to share their vision with the world. Production teams capture these moments, preserving them for generations, sharing them with the people of Minnesota through the Minnesota Public Television Association. Millions of people have access to the state's cultural legacy through the six stations of the MPTA.
The MPTA has created an essential archive. We have this rich tapestry of art making and cultural processes that deserve to be in a larger dialogue with the country. The MBTA is creating online platforms that allow artists and cultural leaders to communicate their work and message across the state of Minnesota and beyond.
The programs produced by the MBTA stations forge an essential connection between local arts and culture and the surrounding community. These programs grow attendance at local venues and institutions. They foster interest and sell work. They attract grants and national attention for the featured artists. And they support arts education, bringing hundreds of resources into the classroom at no cost to local schools. Budgets for all art departments across the state, I'm sure across the United States, are very limited. I can't have an extensive jewelry program here, but I can show them jewelers. I can show them artists out there who use different types of machinery that we have no access to.
As a student in Central Minnesota, I like seeing these artists in these videos because it's very current, and art evolves over time, and we're not seeing an old art form or how it used to be done. We're kind of seeing how it's being used and manipulated today in real time.
Funding provided by the State's Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund to Minnesota's public television stations makes a difference in the lives of artists, art lovers, students, and in the cultural life of our state. And the impact continues to grow. In this biennium, Legacy Funding connected over 5,000 artists and historians with new audiences and supported 40 full-time jobs and hundreds of freelance assignments. Broadcast audiences increased over 80%. And MBTA websites and videos gained more than 3.2 million online views. We are creating an archive of the state's arts and cultural heritage, and we're engaging its citizens every day, on TV, online, in schools, in the community.
Legacy funding is an extremely important educational tool to bridge the gap between art and the
public. We've enjoyed and benefited from the increased offerings on public TV. It is affirming to see the Minnesota cultural landscape reflected in television online.
We homeschool, and legacy funded content is priceless.
Some of the staff.
The impact of legacy-funded programming from the Minnesota Public Television Association grows every year, reaching local artists and historians, reaching local audiences, and making good on the promise of Minnesota's Legacy Amendment. With your support, we continue to tell hundreds of new stories and engage thousands of new audiences at home and around the country.
The full report on our work and the video you've just seen is available on a special website that we've created, www.mptalegacymedia.org. In addition, we've produced for you two data sheets, one of which summarizes the work that we've done, the second, the work we propose to do, and it also has the web link so that you can capture that video again if you so wish. Each of our MPTA member stations has now created many seasons of arts and cultural content, along with documentaries on a wide range of historical topics, thanks to funding from the Arts and Cultural Fund. The programming is produced and broadcast in individual communities around the state, also broadcast statewide on our 24-hour-a-day Minnesota channel. The MPTA stations have each developed websites for distributing and curating this content, and we're now introducing new services to an entire new range of devices, including Apple TV, Roku, and Xbox. And I don't know how to use any one of those, but my children do. Legacy-funded content is also generating exposure, interest, and new consumers for Minnesota art and artists beyond the state of Minnesota. Programming produced by the MPTA is seen regularly on PBS affiliates around the country, and we regularly provide features on Minnesota artists for the PBS NewsHour. We have spoken to artists who tell us that they receive inquiries from outside the state, they receive orders for artwork outside the state, and they are selling artwork from Minnesota in other places thanks to the work that the MPTA is doing. So in closing, we're proud to report that the return on investment in legacy funds provided to the MPTA has been realized many times over, creating jobs that benefit our local communities, growing awareness of our arts communities, increasing sales by local artists who are, in fact, small business people, providing educators with free and easy access to media and tools that they can use in their teaching, and capturing and telling the stories of Minnesota's history. The stations of the MPTA are grateful to you for designating us a grant recipient for the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. In our application for funding in this coming biennium, we seek to continue this valuable work that we have done together since 2009. Your support of this work, capturing and curating the arts, culture, and history of Minnesota in this moment in time, creates a lasting and enduring asset that will serve generations to come. With that, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions anyone might have.
Questions, Mr. O'Reilly? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Appreciate your coming. And last but not least, we have AMPERS. Welcome to the subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joel Glazer. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of AMPERS, which is the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. I want to thank the committee for sticking around late into the evening. For those of you who are still with us, thank you very much. I will keep this brief because it is getting late, and we've had the opportunity to meet with all of you, I believe, individually. So as you know, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Station is an association rather than a network, which means that if you have the ability to be listening to our stations up in Grand Marais, Thief River Falls, or at the same time Winona, Mankato, they are very different because they are programmed by and for their local communities. We are not affiliated with Minnesota Public Radio, nor are we affiliated with Twin Cities Public Television or the Minnesota Public Television Association. We now have 17 community radio stations throughout the state of Minnesota. That is two more than the last biennium, and that's important to point out as we move through our presentation tonight, that in order to stay flat, an increase would actually be flat for the stations because we are not a fiscal agent. We represent each individual stations. The funding flows through the Department of Administration. And therefore, with two new stations, if we were to actually truly stay flat, it would be a decrease for each of the individual stations. There are a total of 16 of the 17 stations plus AMPERS that are eligible for legacy funding. The two new stations, which you'll see in the handout with the map, are KBXE, which is serving the Bagley-Bemidji area in northern Minnesota, and Cloquet WGZS on the Fond du Lac Lake Superior Band of Chippewa. The AMPERS stations serve underserved communities with a special emphasis in minority and diverse communities, rural and student communities. We have programming in 12 different languages, and at any given time, in any given year, we have between about 1,200 to 1,500 students who get hands-on experience within those stations. That means they're actually working on the equipment, having the opportunity to produce programs beyond the air. The stations rely very heavily on volunteers, some as many as 300. And the stations are not allowed to run any commercials. Similar to Minnesota Public Television Association, our legacy report is also 102 pages. I will spare reading it to you this evening. I will give you just a couple of the very brief highlights. Like there's on our legacy, on our page, ampers.org, we do have the full report posted, and you have all received an electronic copy. If you would like a hard copy, we can have that arranged. The AMPERS stations in the last biennium created more than 2,700 arts and cultural heritage programs. More than 75,000 people attended the combined projects, and more than 4,300 students either worked on or attended ACHF programs. We helped to pay 420 artists. One of them is with us this evening. You'll hear from her in just a moment. 150 different contractors and 90 employees. Funds are only used to supplement and never to supplant. We take that very seriously. The best example that I can give you, first of all, we do have a compliance committee. One of our stations a couple of years ago had made a request of our compliance committee. They were in need of a new phone system, and they explained to the compliance committee that about 40% of their phone calls are used for legacy interviews, on-air interviews, et cetera. We reviewed it, and we declined that request. We are basically, our rule of thumb was, if you need this equipment to operate or to for the day-to-day operation, that would be considered, in our mind, supplanting rather than supplementing. So we take that very seriously, and every dollar is scrutinized through our legacy compliance committee. As I mentioned, we have 420 artists that we paid in the last biennium. Ms. Christina Hamm is one of those 420. Rather than telling you how she benefited, I brought her here this evening to share her experience personally.
Ms. Hamm, welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. My name is Christina Hamm, and I was commissioned by KBEM Jazz FM in 2014 to write the Radio Noir, The Black Hand Side, that honored the history and legacy of the local jazz scene in North Minneapolis during the 60s. Documentation on this particular period was hard to come by, but the information that I did uncover provided me with the knowledge to pay homage to our local community and also the politics that defined it. What was most beneficial to me regarding this collaboration was the ability to gain a wider exposure for my work. It's provided me with the opportunity to reach out to a broader range of the artistic community who want to avail themselves to collaborate on a play that I might be working on in the future. It has also given me a calling card as I look to pursue a manager for crossover gigs in television and film. And having a sound file provides ready access for those in an industry where getting your script read is incredibly difficult. I believe the citizens of Minnesota benefited from Jazz Noir by enlightening them about the culturally rich history within their community. Minnesota benefits from the Legacy Amendment because it provides artists such as myself the opportunity to be able to help retain the rich history that is indigenous to Minnesota. This, in turn, enables the state residents to partake in the sharing of this cultural heritage and an ecosystem that creates a dialogue about the state in which we live and keeping its history alive. As a transplant who has now called Minnesota my home for the last 10 years, I consider it an honor to have been called upon to participate in this project, which is archived on the station, and you guys can still listen to it.
Mr. Chairman, members, in FY14, AMPERS also launched Veterans Voices, Memories and Stories of Minnesota's World War II Veterans. You have all, in individual meetings, all had the opportunity to hear examples of those, and that has become a very, very popular part of our legacy programming. During the same biennium, the Humanities Center launched Veterans Voices Project, sharing stories of more recent veterans. In FY15, AMPERS received a $25,000 pass-through grant from the Humanities Center. We broke that out, as you'll see, in our request separately because that was a pass-through grant, so it was not considered part of our base. I would like to, since you have not had an opportunity, and because this, too, is quite popular, it's just a minute and a half, and I was not being rude looking at my phone before I was queuing this up, and we'll just take a quick listen to one of these examples.
We need to be there to support our troops when they come home. You know, today it's common to see support our troops bumper stickers and yellow ribbons and all of that. Fanfare is there very strong. Our mission is to make sure that support has substance and meaning to it in the years ahead as this generation comes home.
This is Veterans Voices, a series exploring the knowledge, experience, and leadership of Minnesota veterans.
My name is Brock Hunter. I served as an Army Recon Scout, primarily on the DMZ in Korea in the late 1980s, right near the tail end of the Cold War. That was sort of the seeds, I guess, of what I'm doing now. I'm now an attorney in private practice. My practice is focused on representing veterans in the criminal court process. What we're trying to do this time around is a better job of identifying those that are coming into the courts as veterans with untreated combat trauma issues, and then to divert them in the court system into more of a treatment response than a strictly punitive response. And it would be a huge waste to abandon this generation of veterans. They can divert all of that life experience in very positive directions and do amazing things here in our community to help us.
Veterans Voices is produced by AMPERS in partnership with the Minnesota Humanities Center and support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at minnesotavets.org.
So those are just a couple of the examples. We also do things like Minnesota History in 90 Seconds, Minnesota Native News, a look at legacy, highlighting the unknown legacy projects. Unfortunately, typically it's only the negative press. So we have done so far 30, and we're doing another 30 little 90-second segments of legacy programs. Those are the AMPER projects. But in addition, each of the stations do things specifically for their local communities and share those all, and those are also then shared online. AMPERS is requesting $100,000 specifically for the Veterans Voices project to expand the production and distribution. In total, we are asking for $4,037,000 from the Legacy Fund for the FY 2016-2017 biennium. Again, the bulk of that really will be going to the two new stations. There is a slight increase for the existing stations. It's a 5% increase, but it is really to keep the existing stations flat and then also be able to take care of those two new stations. If it is the intention of this committee to keep all legacy recipients flat, as mentioned at the beginning of this committee hearing, the appropriation would need to be $3,740,000 to keep all stations. Again, that's $3,740,000 to keep all stations, including the two new stations and Veterans Voices, flat. So with that, I'd like to, again, thank you for allowing us to make our presentation in person this evening. Thank you for staying with us this evening, and thank you for your continued support. And I am available, or we are both available, if you have any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the subcommittee? Okay. Well, thank you very much for
thank you.
So, members, that concludes the evening. I appreciate everybody who testified tonight and the members for sticking around. Tomorrow, prepare for a similar hearing as we hear how many? 36 bills? But we're going to try to do that about 5 minutes a bill is the goal. All right, so we'll see you tomorrow.